think?
Not ready.
Sure.
Ow.
What a way to start a meeting.
Dave.
I thought I had like two of them on talk.
Okay. Can you please sign? If you don't want to speak. No, you just gave me the... Are you ready, Paul? Call to order the Devil's Lake Water Improvement District. First agenda item is the agenda. I'd like to motion that we pull out the financial report and discuss it after the erosion study.
Second.
Okay. All those in favor of approving the consent agenda for the previous meeting minutes?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, motion carries unanimously. Public comment. Looks like we have three people that are signed up to provide public comment today. We are running the timer, so we'll have 5 minutes apiece. Okay. And when the yellow light goes off, that's your 30-second warning, and then there'll be a buzzer to end your time. Larry Brown.
Thank you very much. Just let me know my time up already.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Nice being here, folks. Thank you very much. And those of you at home also. Anyway, that doesn't surprise me a bit. Anyway, just a couple of things I wanted to talk briefly on, and Mr. Skirvin, you'll be happy I made a few notes here this time, so I won't go on for ad infinitum. As you well know, for a long time, I've been opposed to the septic system, and literally, in my opinion, it stinks in more ways than one. I just don't like the basis of our program. I don't like the idea of shutting somebody's water off. I don't like the idea of starting with our most vulnerable people out there in society. Let's say the people who've had septic systems in the longest, who are probably the oldest people on the lake, and we end up going banging on the door of a poor little 90-year-old lady whose septic system is 60 years old and insisting that she spend all this money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to upgrade her system. As you well know, septic systems today can cost $30,000 real easily. And if it were a proven problem on the lake in any way, shape, or form, if we had an E. coli problem, which we've researched ad nauseum, we've taken DNA samples, we found it was dogs, we found it was birds, we found it was geese, we found it was seagulls, we never once found, you know, human E. coli problem. Again, our manager keeps talking about a nutrient load. Nutrient loads created by a gazillion things, the least of which would be a septic system on the lake. We had all the experts come in and testify before us time after time after time. These experts were sanitarians, they were the people that were experts in the field, and they told us from day one, listen, no matter how much inspections you're not going to find many violations out there, because the county and the various other agencies across the U.S. and across the state of Oregon, EPA, DEQ, sanitarians, health departments, all these people who have jurisdiction over septic tanks. And here in the state of Oregon, I was amazed to see the director of the Department of the Real Estate Agency sent out a recent periodical that says 30% of Oregonians use a septic system. That's over 1 million people. Of our 3 million population, 3,800,000 people, or, you know, we're talking about 1 million people in this state using septic tanks. And we're going to do something outside the norm, or do something different, treat our group of people in and around this lake differently than the rest of the state, and I just don't like that idea. And once again, if we had somebody in-house here who was a real expert on it and could prove to me or could prove to other people in the audience that we had a big problem,
That would be one thing, but we haven't done that. And for that reason, I'm adamantly opposed to it, much less walking up and turning off somebody's water. That stinks, in my opinion. The other thing I wanted to talk about briefly tonight, and that is I've seen an awful lot of floating logs and other debris in and around the lake. Myself and many others in previous years, when we see logs floating in the lake and it becomes a water ski season, we see people racing around out there on jet skis. If you hit one of these, let me tell you, you can get hurt. You can get hurt in a hurry. I've hit many submerged logs and things with boats, with Randy's boat, to the tune of several thousand dollars. We've done a lot of damage and had a lot of experience with this. We find these sunken logs, we'll oftentimes try to tow them off in a wetland and just leave them sit there. Well, what happens is winter comes and pretty soon the logs are floating all over the lake. I think we could talk to the city, and many of us who have power boats can hook onto a lot of these logs and a lot of this debris. And if we could tow it to a centralized location, let's say like Regatta Grounds, a year or two ago, this city agreed to pick up debris there for a short period of time. We towed a lot of logs down there. They took those logs and disposed of them on some city properties themselves. I don't think they took them up and had them chipped or anything like that. But I think Bill Sexton indicated recently that we could have those logs chipped at next thing, very low cost to no cost. And that certainly would be a safety factor out on the lake. There's debris floating out there now that has piling attached to it that is half of somebody's dock that blew off in a winter storm. I mean, some significantly big objects that if you were racing across the lake at night, as a lot of people do, you have lights on your boat, but you don't have a headlight out there like you do driving a car. You're going to hit something like that, and you could do massive damage to your boat, if not kill yourself. So I think from a safety perspective, it would be a good idea early in the season, before May 1st, to try to get many of us together, and I'd be happy to be a contributor to that, to hook onto some of these logs, work out something with the city, tow them to a central location, either east side or west side of Devil's Lake, and get this stuff off the lake. It's just a general public safety issue. Just a suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you. Mark Christie.
Thanks. Mark Christie, I need to tell you where I live. 3184 Northeast Live Drive is where our house is. Anyway, if you all recall back in December, I came up in the public comment period and voiced my concern specific to the erosion study and a number of us getting the feeling that in the dialogue that you had with Tetra Tech and the people that were here and the gentleman that was on the phone, that you did not get the information that you wanted out of their presentation. And I was very concerned about that, and I stated that in what I shared with you. And so I'm down at the lake this weekend, and I get the email from Paul letting us know what's going to be on the agenda. And so I look at the presentation part, and I read the part about these new discoveries and new findings and new conclusions. And then I read the subtitles there, and I go, you know what? Unbelievable. What we've got is the thing that's set things that Randy's talked about over the last 2 years, the thing that's that Paul's talked about over the last couple of years, what David's talked about, all of a sudden go from a report that was very statistically data-driven to a report that had unsubstantiated data, and there are many sightings in there that say that, you know, there was no sightings in there of where this data came from. And what I want to specifically read to you is in relationship to boat waves. In the original findings, the appropriate intensity of boat-driven waves was estimated using computational procedures and usage in USACE 2008 data from published literature on other characteristics of wave generated by boats and others similar to those typically used on Devil's Lake, and assumptions regarding the amount of recreational boat traffic in lake. And then we go to another part that says, data on wave characteristics of specific boats that use Devil's Lake area are not available. However, data have been collected by others. Now, what I'd like you to answer in your discussion when you start talking about the additional information that was provided since December is who provided that data. The data that was available was originally cited and statistically valid from Gilmore and Hudson 2005 and documented in the 2008 Gilmore sightings. And then that was a 0.04 to 0.08 feet. And then all of a sudden we go to new information that was provided, review of available information on wakeboard boats, including photographs and videos of these boats in operation, as well as comments from reviewers of the initial draft of this report, which would have been in December, and that would have been, I think, Randy, you spoke specifically to that, indicates that waves generated by these boats may significantly be larger than indicated by the Gilmore 2008 reported attempts to obtain better information from a variety of boat manufacturers were unsuccessful. This direct data can be used to provide more refined estimates of the wave characteristics are not available. It truly blows me away. And what I'd like you to do in your discussion is let me know and let others know who provided this additional data from what you received in December to where we have now. I mean, there's no notes as to where this data came from, and I think we have a right to know who provided the data. And was this Tetra Tech all of a sudden getting data that they hadn't provided in the past, or did Paul and Randy and some other board members contribute that information? And if they did, and if there were videos taken with respect to waves, and all of a sudden you're using statistics that aren't verifiable, then I think that needs to be noted in the document. So, again, my biggest concern that I shared in December is, you know, you didn't get what you want, and now, you know, the information that we've heard consistently over the last couple of years is all presented in these additional findings. And what I'd like you to do also is provide a document that specifically shows everything that was added compared to what the original document was. Just break it out and cite where that information came from. So if you can do that for me, I would be very happy. Thanks.
Thank you. Mitch Moore.
Hello again.
Hello.
So my name is Mitchell Moore, 2929 Northeast Loop Drive, Otis. So, of course, tonight I'd like to comment on the erosion study. The issue tonight is, what do we do with the erosion study? Before us is the re-released erosion study dated March 8th. It replaces its predecessor, November 11th. By design, the RP requested advice on really one topic. It asked, quote, to draw conclusions to be drawn whether the dam operation may be impacting the shoreline. What were the conclusions of the study? Well, the original study, version one, concluded that several factors, including seasonal wave action and local shoreline conditions, are likely more influential on shoreline conditions than relatively small changes in lake elevations. The new study, version two, failed to reach a specific conclusion. The report instead suggests that quantification of this process can only be done through site-specific analyses. In other words, more specific study is required. Indeed, the revised erosion study contains 117 references to the term level in describing the height of Devil's Lake, but there's no statement confirming or denying the impact that lake level has on overall shoreline erosion in this new report. It does not contain a specific recommendation for an ideal lake level, nor does it recommend lowering the lake. So now what? I would caution the board, do not read between the lines and draw a conclusion where three professional scientists engaged by the district have refused. Tonight's agenda suggests two actions related to the erosion study. First is the decision on the completeness of the contract and payment of the contractor. Staff believes that the contract can be ruled complete. Second is a decision on the timely installation of the dam. Staff has recommended delaying the installation of the dam structure until after receiving public comment in the May 10th board meeting. It's unclear if that's a decision related to the height of the impoundment structure or the use of the impoundment structure. Here are a few recommendations on the subject. I would agree that Tetra Tech should be paid. I recommend that the district install the dam on the traditional timeline, on or near April 15th. Unless the district is seriously considering managing the summer recreational lake level without the impoundment structure, it makes no sense to delay the construction. I would further recommend that the district forego any consideration of changing the lake level. Previous public input has established a clear record on the negative impacts that such a change would have on recreational use of the lake while providing no predictable benefit in curtailing erosion. The district should focus on developing mitigation techniques in those areas where the shoreline is unprotected and there is some evidence that the erosion is occurring at unnatural rates. The district should adjust perhaps the current Save Our Shoreline program to meet this need. The program's already demonstrated it can accomplish more working with governmental agencies than it does with homeowners, as evidenced by the rain gardens. Approximately half of the unprotected shoreline occurs in undeveloped areas owned by the state, the city, and the Siletz Tribe. A strategic partnership with these entities could result in a major accomplishment. Perhaps a Rock Creek restoration project. This could include elevating East Devil's Lake Road, eliminating the oil and grime that entered the lake during the wet season. It could include the construction of fish passages underneath the elevated roadway and the addition of public trails, which could heighten public awareness of this sensitive area. So in conclusion, neither version of the erosion study supports a decision to lower the lake level. The district should give up once and for all on these annual attempts to adjust the lake level. The district cannot accomplish its goals without the foundation of public support. A decision to adjust the lake level downward is a sure way to alienate and discourage lakefront residents and the general public. Don't risk your cash reserves defending the district in a lawsuit that will surely be the result of an arbitrary decision such as this. The district should create targeted erosion control projects and create a lasting legacy with they invested in this report. Concentrate your efforts on the project that have measurable results and avoid those that are based on speculative opinions with little guarantee of success. Thanks for letting me share these opinions with you.
Thank you, Mitch. Larry?
I'm Larry Rich, 4590 Northeast Loop Drive. Wasn't really planning on talking tonight, but someone wrote my name down. And I don't want to take away from what Mark and Mitch have already said, but my only two complaints are as far as lake level, when it gets down around 9 feet, I can't get my boat off of my boat slip. And the other thing, as long as I'm here, I would like to mention the, if it's okay to do so, the cyanobacteria sites. I've mentioned this to Paul before, but I live on Thompson Creek Canal, and we always get a bad rap because it's always off the charts. And the sample that is taken from the other side of East Devils Lake Road, where there are about five dogs that live, and I would like to see it taken kind of where the channel comes into the lake. I've told Paul that as far as, you know, he mentioned something about private property, and that's why they take it there. Well, anytime he'd like to, he can walk through our place and take it off our dock. And that's about all I got to say. Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Thanks.
Mark?
Good Good evening. I'm Mark Alder from Tigard, Oregon, but our lakefront address is 3181 Northeast Loop Drive. Apparently, we're part of the Sandpoint Coalition that's coming tonight. Never planned on speaking until tonight. Unlike the first speaker, you don't have to be 90 years old to have lived on the lake. You're a long time. My parents have had a picture of me at 1 month old on our property. So we did it the old-fashioned way. We inherited from my parents, who inherited from my grandparents. So through the years, I have seen quite a few changes in the lake, both in the numbers of people that are there as well as lake levels and some of the things that have gone in, including many boat ramps, many seawalls, as we call them. So I have lived through before you had a dam, which meant that by August we had about 5 or 6 feet of a beach in front of our house, which was fine, because we were lucky enough to have a dock that extended out far enough that we could actually still use our boats. And I seem to remember when the dam was originally put in, originally it was just to keep the grass carp in, because that was, they didn't want them going out, migrating out into the ocean. But I seem to remember that one of the reasons the seawall was put in was to keep the depth of the lake deep enough that the sunlight wouldn't reach the bottom and encourage weed growth. So if you are considering lowering the height of the lake, it would seem to me that you're now going to encourage more weed growth. Now, whether it's native weeds, whether it's milfoil or whatever the ones that we had problems with before, it is always in many ways a multifactorial thing. So the lake has always been a multiple-use lake. I can remember they killed the lake because there were trash fish in it. So I can remember as a little kid walking down and seeing all these great fish that we couldn't catch anymore. So whenever you try to change one thing, you're going to affect more than one person. There's always sort of the Southeast Asia domino effect. So whenever you do one thing, it has ripples throughout the system. So I'd urge you to consider how many people actually use the lake, both living on it and visiting it, and trying to keep the lake a lake that everybody can use and can fish on, can water ski on, can wakeboard on, can sail on. Because I can remember seeing sailboats stopping dead in the water when we had the weed problem, and nobody wants to go back to that. So on my comment thing, it says, what did I want to comment on? I guess, even though I'm only going to be 60 this year, I do bring a kind of an interesting historical view, and I don't have to be 90 years old to have a 60-year-old septic tank system. So I just urge you to consider multiple factors that are taking place. Whenever you change one thing, it takes many other routes that we don't anticipate sometimes to the law of unintended consequences. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, Devil's Lake Plan. And septic tank revitalization program. Seth, still no updates?
No update on that.
Save our shorelines?
So we held the Lakescaper class on this last Saturday. We did it in council chambers, so we were able to record it. I want to thank Charlie, who is the man behind the black screen there, who does all the recording and all the camera work for all these meetings, and he does a great job. He spent a Saturday morning here, and Ron Hurd as well came in to open the building on a day it's generally closed. So thanks to those two. The course went really good. We recorded it, so we're going to be able to get it on Channel 4. It just has to do some final edits, and then that'll be running on a regular basis. We should have that schedule on the website when that occurs. you know, we had about five people there, which is pretty typical. It's the fourth time we've run that class, and it ranges in people from like 5 to 12. We sent out the mailers about it this last time, which people who came really appreciated having those mailers. And really the intention of the mailers was just to tell people about the program. It was a good opportunity for us to send a direct mailer to shoreline property owners. And that has worked out for us. We had another site evaluation that we've completed, and several other people who hadn't heard of the program yet getting a hold of us. So I think for that course, you know, again, we'll do it in a few months or 6 months, try to do it like twice a year. The other thing then to talk about is the we had talked about doing a Save Our Shoreline outreach video. It's something that the district budgeted $5,000 to do this year, basically just to do a 10 to 15 minute film that would be about landscaping around the lake. So I had an opportunity to talk to a filmmaker in town about that, and for right now, the conversation that we had was just like a brief overview of what would be entailed in that. And for tonight, if we could just get a general consensus that this is something we want to continue with, then I'd like to come back at the next meeting with you know, a few different examples of what we could do at different price ranges. You know, we could do something kind of a cheaper version of it at like $500 to $700, going anywhere up to like, I mean, as much as we would want to spend, but I think, you know, up to like $1,500, I think would probably be reasonable for this. So if you guys want to move forward, then, you know, we'll come back with that, giving you sort of the Hyundai version to the Lexus version of a good shoreline video.
I would say go ahead and, you know, bring in some examples and see where we want to go.
Okay.
Anybody?
No, I don't think you need a motion for that. Okay. Just do it.
Right, just general consent. Okay. Different for that.
Vegetation management, Paul?
Okay, so we've got two things on this vegetation management side issue here. To start with, the grass carp, first and foremost. Our consultant, Max Depth Aquatics, reports that his research in the grass carp impacts is progressing. He's continuing to work through some of the salmon interactions, which he thinks are looking more favorable for us. So that's a good thing from the perspective of ODFNW. He and I are going to eventually get down to Newport when his schedule and ODFNW can allow us to get in there and look around, check some files, see what's available with ODFNW that might not be published. A lot of times things get put on shelves, as you might imagine, and there's probably a few things in a file cabinet or two that we want to see what's available and bring that forward. The big thing here, at the last meeting I introduced some ideas around modeling, and I was asked to bring back some information about those models, and what the needs would be for the grass carp application. And so I asked Joe Eilers, who's Max Depth Aquatics principal there, to provide some comments relative to that. And I've printed them in front of you here. And the long and short of it is there was a Hyundai and the Lexus kind of versions here. The Hyundai has some competition. And so he's got another model that he thinks would actually be better than that one. So the Stella model was the first one that was like $15,000, he thought. And that one actually would be applicable for the grass carp. He's got another model that he's been working with. It's a Bayesian neural network model. Ask a modeler what that means. Don't ask me. But it's from the perspective that he's bringing forward, is not only better but cheaper than this $15,000 estimate. He's got an estimate of about $3,300, where he thinks that he can tie in these fish interactions, vegetation growth, and at least kind of show what the outcomes are with probabilities attached. And that's a little bit different than just having like an on-off switch. It's kind of saying a range of probabilities. So in that respect, he thinks, is the way I'm reading it, and I would definitely think that that's better and certainly cheaper. The other two models, kind of the mid-grade and then the Lexus, were the SWAT model, which I think was about $45,000. He doesn't find that that's going to be applicable for the grass carp thing. That's really a watershed modeling technique where you're looking at nutrient loading and trying to say you have how you can best kind of simulate a watershed. And so that's really what that model works for. And then the W2 model, which was developed at Portland State, is really the water quality model granddaddy of them all. And that one really functions, very sophisticatedly around things like chlorophyll A, all this nutrient data that you would add and collect, and it can really help you target and show, okay, if you have your nutrients at this level, by bringing them down to, say, 20% reduction or whatever, what that might look like in terms of water clarity. And it really does a good job of that. How that would apply for the grass carp, it wouldn't in that respect. He doesn't see that that's a real use. So, that was a great tool for other applications, certainly in prioritization of water quality nutrient reduction strategies. The SWAT and the W2 kind of work in conjunction, and you can actually say, okay, well, let's target the Thompson Creek watershed. Okay, what if we got all the nutrient, we figured out what the nutrient loading is there, what if we brought it down to one third of that, and then what does that look like for the lake, and what if we did that for Rock Creek, and where's your bang for your buck kind of thing. So those watershed models are great tools, and I think that it's something that we would look at exploring long term, but for this project it doesn't seem like it's really applicable.
Okay. So you're looking for us to take action on whether or not to do the BNN model?
Yeah, I think it's worth the initial investment. I mean, it was adding maybe a little over 10% to the overall cost of the project. So that's it's not like doubling it. I think that's a kind of a reasonable gain. And so, and I think it can really help demonstrate not only to us but to the audience that we're going to be speaking to, the Fish and Wildlife Commission and ODFNW in general, how these fish interactions and the plausibility of the weeds coming back and what all this means for Devil's Lake. So I get the sense that it is a wise investment.
Have you seen this model used before?
No, I have not. No, certainly not.
I read this, and it looks to me like, the outcome is determined by the inputs, and the inputs, I can't tell if they're guesswork or.
Well, what the inputs are, they are estimates, but they're estimates with a likelihood attached to them, a probability, as I understand it. So, instead of saying there's 100 fish. It's saying there's 100 fish plus or minus 5. And instead of saying there's 680 acres of weeds, it's 680 plus or minus 50, and things like that. So it's adding in that kind of range of probabilities, as I understand it, into the equation, so that when you get an output, it's not just, you're not just getting a number back. You're saying, oh, you're getting a number with some ranges. And it's I think it helps better, it becomes a better estimate by providing a range, I think, and that's how I understand it, and certainly with the way that he's described it.
And I mean, it sounds like it's the only tool that we would have, that he's going to have to estimate those probabilities.
Well, it's definitely a tool for not only estimating it, but also showing how the estimates, showing
the impacts of,
almost like a display mechanism for showing the information. So instead of just having it be in paper form, having it be mathematically represented, what those outputs look like, I honestly don't know. Yes, I haven't seen the model. I don't know. It was new to me. you know, not a mathematician. I was pretty good at algebra, though, thanks to
So what is the timing of this in terms of what he, you know, when he needs to be executing what it takes to use this tool or within the process that he's doing?
Well, this one actually his estimates are pretty tight as far as opportunity. It doesn't seem like it would take much of a time investment. That's why the costs are down. So it's really, I think he's put on here 32 additional hours. So where those 32 additional hours falls into his slate of projects, I can't answer that. But it doesn't seem like it would be extending things too much.
I was just in terms of, you know, understanding when he actually needs to fit this into his work.
Needs a decision.
Whether or not we can see a demo and get a better understanding of the tool, or just authorize if it would be something that we would have to, you know, at your discretion, mm-hmm. whether you think it's a good thing if it has to be done before our next meeting, kind of a situation.
Yeah, I would say that it wouldn't have to be done by the next meeting, based on the fact that we've got a contract that's only, we're only probably 20% into it. And so there is quite a road to go yet. So in that respect, I think that it'd be safe to see if we can, you know, dig up, I guess, some information on the model itself, what maybe the outputs would be. Be happy to try to chase that stuff down.
Is this the only model that he really thinks has real merit?
Well, no, the Stella model he's worked with as well. That was that $15,000 one. $15,880 was his estimate. And that model he's used before, and he thinks it works really well.
Well, why does he make the statement? However, because it is deterministic, it doesn't tell us anything about the uncertainty and the possible outcomes. I mean,
because
that sounds like a drawback.
Yeah, exactly. And so the Bayesian network, neural network model, is not that kind of just fine yes or no kind of thing. It's a yes with a probability of yes to say, you know, 10% or something. It's more. I guess it gives you more confidence in what you're looking at because you know within the range that the model it gets back to what Brian was asking about you know it's what's based on the inputs. Hmm. Well, at least you instead of just saying you know if you don't know what you're putting into is completely accurate, then what you get out isn't going to be completely accurate. But if you put it in there with the range of accuracies that you know them to be, the precision that you think that data represent, then you get outputs that speak to that range of probabilities, that range of precision.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think the point of hiring Joe Ayers was that we trust basically that he's going to be able to come up with and defend the inputs better than anybody else available. And he's recommending this. The cost is it's pretty inexpensive. I mean, in the big picture, mm-hmm.
He's well respected in his field. He's done all of these models at different with the exception of the BNN, which one he's just exploring in different roles. He's got it's actually his son that's the modeler in the family is the mathematician Ben. And you know they've worked with ODF&W on Diamond Lake. You know they did the whole water quality model for that. You know the big one. They definitely know models. You know, certainly infinitely more than I do. In fact, Joe knows infinitely more than I do on all topics related to. I think he's quite an astute limnologist. So glad that he's on our team.
All right. Well, I'll make a motion that we authorize an additional expenditure of up to $3,500 for a Bayesian neural network model, specifically for the grass carp application.
I would second that.
Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Dash.
Okay, so I'm actually going to ask that we just skip this. We had some technical difficulties. This just was going to show a video. The computer screen is not hooked up, and that's where the speakers are, and that video requires. Okay. So if that works for you, we can bring that back.
Do it next month?
Yeah.
Fair enough. The erosion study.
Sewer.
Oh, we had sewer in there, too.
Oh, do we have sewer?
Yeah.
Oh, so we do. See that. Sewer.
I just have the update that we sent that letter regarding the key points that were illustrated regarding the environmental benefits and the social benefits and the economic kind of stipulations that were put into the original LID application. We haven't heard anything back yet directly, but I think we can maybe expect something in the coming month or so to see where this the city. I mean, that's all the information I have. So I do know that they did receive the letter.
Well, why do you expect something in the next month or so?
Well, I did speak briefly with the city engineer, and she just told me that they had the letter and that they were working on it. And so I'm just kind of putting a guesstimate on there as far as, you know, the idea, my understanding was to keep moving this forward for August pave and installation date. So if that's still on the queue, then, you know, we're definitely want to see this move forward on all accounts. I really don't have any direct way of saying when it'll come back, though. We'll have to go to City Council, though. I think there's, you know, obviously the, you know, those 15 steps that you had laid out in, or I think there are 15 or so. We're, you know, one of those steps is bringing it back to council, so it has to come back through.
I can tell you that the city manager's biggest factor, it seems to me that the biggest factor in determining what his recommendation will be to the city council is how fast the city can recover its initial investment, which kind of surprises me, I think. And so we did address that in the letter. We talk about it clearly provides significant long-term financial benefit. If you just look at it in terms of just the financial benefit, obviously the entire cost gets paid back by the property owners with interest in the case of deferred payments. Then on top of that, the city collects system development charges from whoever hooks up, and the city collects sewer rates from the additional hook, and in a place where otherwise they're not going to be collecting any of those revenues. So long term, I mean, it's clearly a winner just in financial terms. So this focus on the short term kind of bothers me, given the history of efforts to try to get, you know, sewering of the lake started somewhere, some way, somehow. And it not happening. And in fact, I think we're farther away from it. We've been farther away from it, or we are now, except for this project, than we were 30 years ago, when there was really serious discussion about really starting to get the project started to the extent that you know, you were getting letters. You could get a letter from the city planner saying to a mortgage company saying, "We believe that this property will be served by sewer within 5 years," so that to encourage the. It was something that mortgage companies wanted at that point in time for some reason. Well, not for some reason. It was important to their security. But anyway, so then we get to the issue of, well, it's easier if this could be funded internally by the city rather than having to go to outside apparently there are significant costs for going to for outside funding that have not yet been explained to me. So there was discussion early on when this were initially talking about this project that the internal funding could come from a specific fund. And I think city people were talking about the capital improvement fund. Well, and the cost of the project, however, and this is why they've now are talking about outside funding, has come to slightly exceed the annual amount in the capital improvement fund, and so I'm going to suggest that the property the project could easily be divided into two parts, one part funded 1 year. The capital improvement fund replenishes every year, so. You could do sewer 1 year and paving the next year, and each half could be funded within the capital improvement fund. So, did I report all this last meeting?
No, I think this is new. So, yeah, thank you.
Okay. So, I mean that's a, and so to me, I think it boils down to is that money in the capital improvement fund going to get spent on something else? And I think we just need to fight for the sewer for this project to be a priority, to be funded from that fund. And I think that's, if there's going to be a battle on this issue, I think that's where it's going to be. That's my current report and the status of the situation.
Thanks, Brian.
Yep.
Okay. Erosion study, Paul.
Okay, so I'm going to go through this shoreline erosion study for you, and the objective of this tonight is to provide a review of the contract, to highlight, demonstrate completeness, show additional information and major new findings. We will go over a number of the existing findings as a result of going through this, but the focus will be on getting to complete. Okay. So first, just some background here. Contract was awarded to Tetra Tech Incorporated December 29th, 2010, over a year ago, for $28,840. So, sizable chunk of change here. Field work was done last summer, and the original presentation and data were submitted on December 1st, just last year. And so we're well into 16 months on this project. And the final submittals, actually some of them we just got last week, so we're happy to have those. And the project was broken up into six forms, okay? There were six tasks. And I apologize for not being able to do this as well, because I should be able to look at this screen. This screen's not live, and so I'm having to look to the big screen here with you for my cues as well. But so it was broken up into six tasks, and in December we ruled those either complete, partially complete, or incomplete. And what I've done in this new review is highlighted in blue and bold where those things that were previously incomplete or partially complete are now complete. So on the next slides, as you'll see the blue and bold, that's where the changes have come. So task number one, in a historical lakeshore review, and the big things here were getting these aerial photographs, which we got from 1939 to 2007, some really great aerials that we have now. What wasn't complete was getting those actually, it's a technical term, ortho-rectified or geo-rectified into the software that shows them correctly on the map. We can do a demonstration for the folks some other time, I think, on that, what that looks like if you're interested. And then also they were to have created a short animation of the aerials. And so now we have that, and I'd like to actually show you that tonight. So this is the front page. And what you'll see is zoomed in sections of the lake, and it'll just flash from like 1939 to present time, more or less, for each area. The 39 aerials are only available along the highway. It was an ODOT aerial shot, so we're not going to see those up in the back end of the lake here. But as you watch this, I think it's pretty revealing. So we've heard some comments about the watershed and some changes people have seen. And this actually really shows it. So there's 39 of the D River. You see the lagoon coming in, carved in there, the 60s. See that the campground is in now. You see the development on the shoreline and up in the watershed. There's the 83, the 92, 2001, and then 07. And so now we'll move along the lake and see that again. And you really see the changes in the watershed. That's really where the changes are being seen, which affects the water quality downstream. Obviously, that's why the watershed is so important. You can see Indian Shores there develop now. And pretty much the whole front of this is completely developed at this point, as you notice. So, Regatta Grounds, 1962 here. And we get more and more sophisticated aerial photography. So, the 2007 data aerials are very, very detailed, and you can zoom right in on these things too, which is really nice for the long-term use. To be around where the hospital would be, in the left corner. Now we're up the Northwest Arm, 1962, running forward. And you can see Niatsu in particularly here is this area. There's no music. It wouldn't have worked. The audio was, we didn't have any audio mics tonight, but... Okay, so this is the Northeast Arm, and you can see this is kind of Niatsu here too. Horseshoe Bay would be up and right in here. Okay, now we're on Sand Point. You can see Sand Point. And then you see the area kind of getting developed here with the canal coming in here. And then this last one's Rock Creek Basin, all the way down in here. This whole area is Rock Creek. So it comes into the lake at the south end. So that's that. That video is actually on our website, so people can watch that on the website, too. Task two was basically soils and vegetation, and there were just a couple of things to get on completed on this, mostly done. They did a great job here. What they basically did is they did a shoreline assessment, collected data on the vegetation. The land use was a residential, commercial, open space. What the bank stabilization may or may not have looked like, was it riprap, was it vegetated, was there retaining walls, was it bare ground? And then the shoreline condition, was it eroding or not? And this map here on the right actually shows the erosion in yellow, which we had them change to yellow so it would be clear. On the other map wasn't so clear. And they did a better job, I think, representing how all this other colors, what they represent, and that's all the soil types. So that's a nice added there. And this is just some photos from actually Dr. Pennington's slide that was presented in December. So that's a straight photo from a slide from them there. And it just shows some of the conditions that were observed. Part three was the photographic survey and characterization. This was by and large like completed when they submitted the data. All that was missing was the actual field sheets, which we have a stack, you know, two reams, three reams of paper, which are the actual data records, and the digital formal summary we had to review and ensure that was all complete, which is now for sure. And this slide is also from Dr. Pennington's presentation in December. And it just shows kind of what we were looking at doing out there with the photographic survey and the land use data collection. The inundation maps. This actually starts mostly looking pretty good, but actually when they went to relook at these data, in the original files that I sent out on the web, this one was colored in black, this FEMA map. Well, what actually happened, we had thought that was complete because they had provided it to us and we just assumed it was complete. Well, there was some inaccuracies in the way they converted the data. So the maps that they had provided to us in December were actually wrong and showed that the areas, for the flood zones. So that has been corrected, and we'll show you those, what that means. And then these same maps, these same digital images of the inundation needed to be provided to us in a format that could be seen read with the GIS system that we have, this ARC map 9.3, that's what that is. It's the computer file system, which now is complete. And then lastly, it needed to be put into a publicly viewable animated file, such as what we just saw. So now we have this file, which is also on the web, and we'll zip through this too. And this is the inundation zones, and it kind of does the same thing. It shows you by area what it looks like at 8.3, 9.0, 9.53, which would be the full water right, 10.4, which was the ordinary mean high, typically would occur in the winter. A 10-year interval flood and a 100-year interval flood. And then it just does that for each section of the lake. Really starts getting interesting on a 10-year interval flood. Now, and what they actually stated in the document, which I think is important for people just to realize, that these 10-year floods don't happen on a 10-year interval. There's like a 10% chance that they can happen during the year, and there's a 100-year flood can happen any time during the year too. So, you know, it's just Mother Nature decides on when that's going to be. But so the FEMA data that they converted had that 100-year flood at 17 feet, I think it was something, 17 point something. And now it's actually the corrected data, I believe, is 14.0. So there's the 12.9, which was inaccurate, and then the 14.0, which was, I think, about 17 feet in the original documentation. So we're happy to have that corrected.
You mean, are you saying that anybody that lived on the lake was told what the new floodplain or a level would be and stipulated how where you had to build a house or couldn't build a house? Are you saying that that's changed now?
No, I'm just saying that when they imported the data, they did a calculation incorrectly, and they came up. It had something to do with going from a projection within the GIS to the mean sea level that the rest of the data were at. So instead of, you know, the published number might have been 17, but it would have been based on a different type of map projection. So these are the corrected data.
So, Paul, when we're talking about inundation levels, are all properties pretty much equal as the water rises, or are some affected?
Oh, there's definitely some that are vulnerable. Like Sand Point right here goes underwater at 14 feet. So, yeah, there's definitely different areas that are lower, which are going to get it first. The, you know, like the canals around First Street are very low, and at 11 feet, which we have every winter, you know, that first and second street are like flooded. So those properties are very vulnerable. And this just talks about that conversion. So here's this 17.9, which is in, and this is just GIS speak. You know, this really is a technical conversion versus 14.0 mean sea level. So that's where the error was. They just had changed, incorrectly brought that in. Okay, so task five is the wave and action analysis, and we're going to move along a little quicker now and get to some updates. But basically, they were supposed to have provided wave action analysis at varying lake levels that hadn't been done. They did not do it with any of the soil types. They didn't bring any information relative to that to the table, frankly, nor with any riparian states, which is the different vegetative states along the shoreline. Probable energy did not provide the anthropogenic boat wave from another cast of boats. They only had provided one, and we'll talk about how they came up with some additional data through some calculations that they were able to do. And then the report should have reflected on these types of things. Again, the riparian zones, the wetlands. They did, and the only thing they brought into was these armored shorelines. That's really the only thing that they had brought reference to. They didn't speak about, you know, a bare soil or a vegetated soil environment. Etc. So those were key components that were asked for, which were just not part of that original submittal. But what was part of that submittal was this information. They had the wind data. You'll remember that slide that they provided. This slide here, which showed that the boat energy averages 40 to 45% of wind energy on the shoreline. These are some estimates that they made. Or 28 to 31% of the total of the total, and so this was stuff that they had, you know, provided before. And then task six is the written report, and the written report suffers, frankly, because of the analysis that they didn't put into the other parts. That's where it shows up the most. So you see a lot of blue here. There was no information about reservoir hydrology, vegetation distribution. They didn't mention grass carp. It was specifically called for in the RFP. There's just a number of things that were totally not referenced at all. Just no beginning point. The vegetation distribution, I have a kind of a partial check mark there, and one other one. I frankly think they could have gone farther, but I think for by and large, given the total project, I think we can recommend that it is complete. And this other one, too, soil saturation during impoundment. They brought some information forward. I would have personally preferred a little deeper look at it. I think it would have been more interesting to have a little bit more information on any of these, but that those in particular. And then we'll just go through the next slides, because what we've got now is, and you know, we're still only about halfway through this presentation, so bear with me, are the major updates and additions, okay, to this report from December to now March 27th. And some of these we've already seen. So we've got more accurate inundation maps. We've got the inundation movie. We've got the geo-rectified aerials. We've got the historic aerial movie, which we saw. The format of the report has been overhauled. That was their choosing. There's been additional studies. There's been additional wave scenarios added, which they provided. Additional figures, additional analysis, and recommendations and considerations have been provided. So knowing that, we'll look at some of these that we haven't looked at already. And then the way we're going to go through that is by looking at the additional findings and clarifications. And this slide is the first of two of these clarifications and findings. And I've got a slide for each one of these bullet points. So a clarification was that the full impoundment is 27 additional acres of land inundated. They spoke about this 2 acres originally, and that was really just from 90 to 953, but we really needed to know what's from 83 to 953. You'll see that in a chart. And this is all in the report, which people can pick up online. They had reported that there was 16% of the shoreline eroding. We just were curious, what does that mean in miles? Can you provide that? It's approximately 2 miles. The highest area of erosion currently are areas most impacted by summertime and wind waves. So this is something that they were able to tease out of those charts that they had given before. Remember how Tony was referring to, well, I think that stuff is in there, it's just we haven't brought it forward. Well, this would be a perfect example of that. Of looking at where, you know, just by looking at those maps that they provided, turn them into yellow markings, we can see it, let's put it in the text too, and that's what's been done. The operation of the dam has reversed the natural hydrology, the lake flow. The highest average lake levels now occur since 1998 to current, basically. The highest averages, the monthly averages, occur in May and June versus the winter. And you'll see their documentation of that. With the dam, the wave energy is now focused on a narrow bandwidth year-round, more or less year-round. And I like to think of this one as the beaver analogy. So there's a beaver, and it's at a narrow bandwidth down, effectively. If it actually scaled up the tree, in fact, wouldn't do a very efficient job. But that's an idea just to keep in the back of your head is what that might mean, narrow bandwidth. And then boat wave energy, they had an 18% total wave energy, but based on some additional calculations, it could be as high as 49%. So it's kind of gets at some variability in trying to provide a little bit better range of information, which I like. So for the first bullet, you have this table 4. This is straight from their report. Here's that 2 acres between 90 and 953. And then if you look at 83 to 953, it works just like a times table. 27 additional acres, and they actually provided the total surface area acres. So these are just some refinements to the data set that I think make this thing a little better and more appreciated. So it's all in chart form and as well as in the text. And then you can see the 10-year flood, 12.9, and the 100-year flood, and what that would mean for the surface area of the lake. 143 total acres. It'd be a pretty wet environment. And then this was like a clarification too. So instead of just providing information about the percent erosion length, we actually asked for, excuse me, for them to add the percent of the total shoreline. So just better representing, showing us more clearly what that meant, you know. And so this, they did, I think, a good job of that with this pretty simple table. And what that shows here, that the total linear footage of a shoreline, soil types, the total shoreline is basically 12.1 miles. And they just sum that for us. And then the total eroding is, you know, just over 10,000 miles, or about 1.9 miles. Yeah, about 10,000 feet and or 1.9 miles. Thank you. And then this map you've seen just before from the soils map, but it's just showing again here. In yellow is areas of erosion, the highest area of erosion, because we asked them to provide us some compilation information here. And this helps, I think, show that pretty clearly. Where before, I think the map, this color blended in with all these other soil types. It just really wasn't very clear. So this just helps, I think, the reader to better understand what's being shown here. So this is figure 3 from their document. And what's interesting here is it's these areas of yellow correspond to areas impacted by northwest wind direction, so summertime wind. So at about 10 o'clock in the morning in the summer, if the sun's going to come up, it's going to start blowing from the north, and it's going to blow until, what, 5 o'clock. This is how our lake works. So in summertime, the wind energy is coming down the lake. And so these areas are impacted by summertime wind waves, as is this area. In the big wintertime storms, the wind direction is this way, from the southwest, comes up the lake. So this area isn't even impacted. There's no fetch there for a wave to actually be created in this area. There's no fetch at all. It's zero. So with the wintertime events, lost my cursor, the wave energy crashes way up here, but it's not necessarily hitting this shore either. Certainly not as directly as, say, from the northwest in the summertime. So that's how they've shown that.
So, Paul.
Yes.
Page 2, I think it is, of the report.
Mm-hmm.
Is talking about wind. What you were talking about. It reads that, and I'm just confused, reads that in the summertime that we have northwest and wintertime we have south to southwest winds, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then farther down there, I'm going as fast as I can here.
Are you in the study itself?
Yeah. Are you? It changes. The page is 52 pages long. On page 16,
it reads
winds from the northeast during the winter months. So it says, it reads, these data generally indicate that the winds blow predominantly from the northeast during the winter months.
Yeah, and that is confusing. And what that is from is the predominance. There is actually, which seems kind of strange, but in the winter we always expect the wind to be coming from the southwest because that's where the big wind events come from. But those are infrequently occurring. So predominantly there's a gentle wind that comes from the northeast, and that's all that's saying. So this is Table 7 from the document, and it's talking about wave energy as a function of boats and percent of total wave energy on the shoreline. And so what they did originally, and referenced here with Glaymore from 2008, is they had provided this study where they showed that basically a wave that comes ashore that's 0.8 feet, which is about, what, 8-9 inches, as it comes ashore, it provides 2,000 megawatts of energy per foot.
Hmm.
Okay. And that by itself equaled 18% of the total wave energy for the year. So just these waves can produce up to 18% of the year. Now, there was a question from the district as to whether this 0.8-foot wave was reasonable.
I remember this portion of the conversation because, you know, previous director, Mr. Strayer, had asked the question specifically about, you know, that not representing the activities around wakeboard boats or wake surf boats that are becoming more popular in the, you know, in the watershed. So I can see that that's where they probably, you know, drive some what-if scenarios against it. I did have a question in regards to this, because on page 2 it's showing a range representing 40% to 50%, but in this section of the document it actually references, you know, the 17 or probably rounding up to 18%, 18% to 49%. So I was just wondering if the executive summary was referencing the same information or if it was trying to.
I assume so. I would have to look closely at that again. There may be a typo there. You know, I found a typo later on. You know, which they actually it was related to this very slide. In the text right around the slide, it talks. It mentions something about or it used to. It said the range is from 2,000 to 8,600, but they were talking about these only this section between 2,800 and 8,600. It was they had just incorrectly put that. So they do have there could be another error in there too. We'll have to look at that.
I think just farther up in the next sentence, it explains that. It says that total energy associated with the boat waves of 1.5 to 2 feet. So if you drop down to the 1.5 to 2 feet, then you get into that 40 or 50% of assumed wave energy.
Mm-hmm. And what they did is, because we had a public comment question how they came up with this, and we'll just let them know now, is what they did is they took this information, this 0.8, get my cursor back here, and they did the calculation based on just some estimates. They took some numbers. Well, what if it was a 1 foot wave? And what if it was a 1.5 foot wave? Okay, what if it was a 2 foot wave, which is kind of more like what you were saying the questioner had asked about. And what would that look like? So this wave kind of simulates that big wake surf wave, where you've got a wakeboard boat that's got basically almost a 4 foot wave right off the stern of the boat, right? And then that wave comes ashore, and at the rider it's about 2.5 feet, you know, surfing. And then when it comes ashore, if they are, you know, 70 feet out, which hopefully they're, you know, even a little more than that, it's 2 feet high still. And if you use that number, then you can calculate the megawatts per foot. And if you use that megawatts per foot and you look at the megawatts per foot from wind waves, as you had before when you calculated these other top numbers, these are the total utilizing all wave energy, then the numbers change because you've created, you know, you're simulating a higher wind wave, and therefore the energy percentage goes up. And what I find really interesting, and you'll see this in any wave data set, it's shown in one of the other figures that we've not presented tonight because it was part of the original document. It showed the how the intensity increases, the energy increases. It's like it's not just a 1-to-1. So if you have in this example 0.8 feet wave and then a 1.5 foot wave, that's basically a doubling of the wave height, a little less than that. Well, that doesn't just double the energy, it almost triples it. That's because the wave, if the wave can get up to that high, it's gonna crash harder. You know, big waves have more energy. It takes more energy to push them up there. They're going to release that energy when they crash. It's just physics. You know, these are just scenarios that they calculated based on a couple estimates, just some numbers. They said, well, if 0.8 is seen, what would it look like at 1 foot? Yeah. And at 1 foot, it almost is like a 50% gain. You know, it changes pretty quickly.
Well, I guess the thing that I'm struggling with on this data set is, what does percentage of annual wind energy, what does that represent? You know, because is the assumption that each one of those line items is a what if, that all boats that are traveling on the lake are producing that much energy, therefore we're at a 95% of the average wind energy, or is that...
Yes.
How do we get to what is the calculation that we can use to assume 10% factor of a wakeboard boat versus a ski boat? You know, if we had like a... Where would we be from a conclusionary perspective if we had, that mix of different types of assumptions around the number of boats that are running, right? Because that's a hard representation.
Yeah. Mathematically, I think you could get there. But you're dealing with equations that are not linear, so it's not going to be...
So you're good with algebra, I thought.
Yeah, that's... I'm not going to do algebra on the fly tonight.
Okay.
but what this is showing is the percent of annual wind energy. So this original number here is 22% of what the wind energy would be, which is when you sum the wind energy and the wave, the boat wave energy, and then you look at that as a percentage, it's 18%. Okay, if you increase the wave size, and if this became, say, the common wave that you saw, okay, then it becomes basically 95% of the wind energy. It's an equivalent. It's basically a one-to-one. There's as much wakeboard energy as there is 70-mile-an-hour windstorm energy. I mean, a wakeboard wave is huge. And a 70-mile-an-hour windstorm is maybe throw a 3-foot wave, too. You know what I mean? They're comparable sizes. And it's really the size of the wave that dictates the energy, if that makes sense. So if you had a situation that you had... a situation where it was just a wakeboard dominated setup, like all summer, in the future. Then, and you had the same amount of climactic conditions where you had the wind of the northwest winds in the summer and the southwest strong winds of the winter, and that remained the same. Then that percentage would be almost become a 1-to-1. And as a result, then the total wave energy would be basically 49% of the total wave energy, because the total wave energy, say, is in megawatts per feet, double the 86,000. The boat wave energy is 86,000 of that, more or less. So that's how they did this. They just used Glamar, and then they use their simulation to come up with these numbers based on wave characteristics that are written in physics textbooks. That, if you were an engineer, you'd have sitting on your desk, I assume. So, I hope that explains that for everyone, how they came up with those.
Okay.
The next item here is something I alluded to earlier about this, May and June being the months where we have the highest average lake level. Okay, this is a kind of an interesting chart. It's got a lot going on in it, and people at home can't see this unless they've got their slideshow handy, which, of course, it is. This is available on the web. But on the left-hand side of this column, it talks about the average lake level in feet, and the numbers go from 12.0 down to 8.0. And so the average lake level in January is by this tick mark. And that tick mark is right about 9.5. Now the range of ability in January, you have a lake level, I don't want a cursor, that can be as high as 11.8. And the record goes back from January 1998 to 2011.
Let me ask you this question. Do you have an idea of what it is in the last few days? Because I can picture it right now.
About 10.3.
10.3?
I'll take that as a 10.3. I hadn't checked it myself. So the variability is ranges from 11.8, we'll say, to 8.8. But the average is about 9.5. You get a big rain event, or the D River gets clogged up. And you're going to get a data point that sits at 11 feet plus, and that's when we get the phone calls from the Crystal Lagoon area saying our house is going to flood. You know, I mean, these are rare events. And a further slide actually shows you how rare of events. But nonetheless, it is the range. But the average sits down here. Now, as you get further down February, the lake level tends to be averaging a little less, less variability to where it changes where we put the dam in. And then the lake level average increases. And actually, in May and June are the highest average lake levels for the whole year. And they have the least variability, too. They actually don't swing that much. The lake level doesn't change that much because it's being controlled. And then, so that's what that looks at. And then what this points out here is July is the lowest rainfall. And this line coming down and going back up is a rainfall. And that is based on this other column here, the average monthly precipitation in inches, I believe it says. And so the lowest rain is in July, and it's nearly about as dry. September gets a little bit more rain. But with the lowest rainfall, yet it has a higher than average lake level than some of the most rainy months of the season. It has, it's higher than February, March. I didn't put April in there because that's when we're kind of manipulating it. October and November. So even with these, in November you get this really high variability because you get all this rain. The rain value is up here too. Its average is below 9.5. That's what that shows. So it's showing a change in the natural hydrology. Instead of having these means, these average monthly descending through the summer, expect the lake level to drop off when the precipitation does, it does the reverse. And this actually looks at this again. It looks at it on a frequency. So this is a very complicated slide, and we could spend 45 minutes on this slide. But this middle region here, right in here, is between 10 and 90% of the time something occurs. So that means in the 80% of the time, something is going on in here. The lake level is in this range. And we've got two lines. We've got the winter line, which starts really high because you do note from the previous slide, there are some events that the lake level is very high in the winter. But it drops, and 80% of the time, it's in this region. 10% of the time, it's in this region. 1% of the time, it's way up here. And then 1% of the time, it's way down here. What this 99% means. So it's, and then this is basically zero. It's like never really down here. So these are the extremes, and that's the way this chart is set up, is to show where the extremes are. Now, what's interesting about this is the blue line is the summertime lake level, and it starts, as you might expect, lower than the wintertime. There's a percentage of time, 1% or so, that it's above 10 feet. Like, you know, the dam is in, and we get a rain, and it blocks up a little bit, and that's where that data point would have come from, real data point that we would have observed. Now, 10% of the time, that lake level in the summer is exceeding about 9.8. And then when we get into this range, it actually crosses this other line. Instead of dropping down and kind of being a kind of a regular curve, it kind of does the opposite. It bows the other way. And we actually have situations where the summer lake levels are higher than the winter. So we've really switched it around. And this actually just shows it a little bit more simply. It shows just the annualized median lake level during the recreation and non-recreational periods, summer and winter again. Not to be confused with extreme storm events. And the average in the summertime, 10 out of the last 14 years, the summertime averages has been higher than. And what we see here is also when the dam was repaired. And that's what that shows too. This shows when the dam was repaired around 2005, 2006. And then when the water rights assessment was first evaluated between the 08 and 09. And so when the water right was reevaluated, we see a dip because it was lower by virtue of coming back to within compliance. This summer time drops, which makes sense. Okay, so that was the first set. We're getting pretty close to the end. Thank you for your patience. The second set of findings and clarifications. The lake level has significant impact on the erosional characteristics of waves. So this is talking about lake level and how waves interact. Significant impact on the erosional characteristics of waves. Artificially maintaining the lake level focuses wave energy, potentially increasing erosion on that point. That's that beaver alluding to before, where you're focusing the energy in one spot and versus up and along a wider regime of lake levels. The dam has narrowed and therefore focused the impact zone where is for bandwidth. And this is critical here. This next one, shallower water allows waves to break, dissipating wave energy. We'll look at the clarifications. And then increasing the lake level increases the tendency for erosion. So by raising the lake level, we're increasing the tendency for erosion. Native vegetation has many benefits and challenges. So we'll look at what they say about each one of these independently. So location. Fetch versus the vertical location. So there originally was an argument that the lake level did not matter, right? We had heard that from them. The lake level doesn't change the fetch. And I agree. And I totally, wholeheartedly agree that by creating an extra 27 acres of footprint of the lake doesn't really change how much distance fetch, that's the word for fetch, there is for the wind to blow and therefore the wave to form. Fetch, we can concur on. What I don't believe they put in the report, and which they now rightfully do, is that the vertical location where the wave actually hits does make a difference. And so from page 32 of the document, and you can follow along again at home, page 33, and my glasses on here. Although the lake level has an insignificant effect on the amount of wave energy approaching the shoreline, it can have a significant impact on the erosional characteristics of those waves, depending on the specific vertical location at which they impact. So where they impact, the vertical spot matters. And so that's a nice clarification for the document. Focusing the wave impacts. Focusing energy at one level. So now, again, page 34 in the document, I'm quoting their document here, so this isn't my words. Artificially raising the water level to one specific point on a yearly basis artificially isolates the still water line, potentially increasing erosion to one area that would otherwise change throughout the year. So that's that beaver analogy. That's like by focusing in one spot, you're driving all the energy to that one spot instead of potentially eroding up and down a shoreline, you're focusing it on one spot, and that's going to make that spot weaker. I mean, we can all recognize that you put all your focus on one spot, that's where your energy is going to be focused, that's where the erosional impacts are going to be. And this is their slide, but these are just data that, you know, represent the lake. This is Devils Lake's water levels, and what they did is they took from 1998 to 2001, and they took the summer recreational period, so this is just the summertime, and they're showing the height of the lake in throughout the year, throughout the summer, and there's a min, a max, a 10% exceedance, a 75% exceedance, and a median. So if people are familiar with a box whisker plot, this could convey into a box whisker plot really easily, but they've chosen a different way of doing it. So you're showing the minimum and maximum. So the maximum is up here, the minimum are down here, and then often at 10% of the time it's down this low, and 10% of the time it's this high, and then most of the time between 75% and 25 and 75%, it's between here and here, and then the mean is right there. So it just shows you, you know, the upper limits, what the 10% limit is, what the 25%, what the average is, what the bottom 75%. And it does that for each year. And what this shows here is that after the dam was repaired, we just have a narrowing of this zone. Lake level is just being held more tightly. That still water height, where the lake would go if the wind wasn't blowing and the wakeboards weren't on it, is becoming narrower. And so that is focusing, it's concentrating when those wakeboarders are, the wind blows. Wave energy dissipation. I alluded to this earlier. So this is just kind of setting it up. On page 34, you can read in the text, differences in lake level can also affect the erosional characteristics of unarmored or partially armored areas. And then they continue. In shallow areas, where the depth is less than about 1.25, 1.25 times the wave height, the wave breaks, causing significant turbulence and dissipating the energy before the wave reaches the shoreline. So what that means is that when in a shallow area, when the wave comes in and it actually hits the bottom of the sediment, it starts slowing down, and it starts becoming turbulent, and it starts to break. Well, when it breaks, that energy that was moving is now, and so it dissipates before it hits the shoreline. And we live at the ocean. We see this every day.
This is what creates the 12% grade or whatever.
Yeah, it's what creates a beach kind of in front of your house. It's hitting the beach, and so it's rumbling along, and then it crashes on the beach. Versus if it's deeper, it's not going to hit the beach. It's going to flow across the beach because it's too deep, and it's going to hit the wall or going to hit the whatever is next. It's going to keep flowing by. There's nothing to slow it down. And so in shallower areas, you actually get that energy dissipation. So, therefore, where the topography of the lake bottom, also known as bathymetry, because that's what the other term is, bathymetry, is flatter than the shoreline, the approaching waves will impart more erosive energy in the wave impact zone at higher levels, because there will be less tendency for breaking and energy dissipation prior to reaching the shoreline. So that basically sums up what I just described previously. It's basically, if it gets too deep, there's no bottom for it to hit. There's nothing for it to bounce off of, so it's going to hit the shoreline. Okay. Retaining walls, wood, concrete, or rock. So in their original document, they did make reference to retaining walls, and I mentioned that they had addressed the impacts on armored shorelines. And they said two things. They said two things. That wave energy is absorbed, quote-unquote, I believe, off the actual text, by the armored structures. And they said that it can also overtop a wall, or it can, if a lake level's low, it can hit the bottom of a wall. So those were what was in the original document. What they're saying now is that no, it's not absorbed. So this might have just been a typo, frankly. I don't know where they came up with the word absorbed, but it certainly wasn't correct. Because it's not. Wave energy does not get absorbed by a vertical face. It gets reflected. I mean, it's just very clear science. We don't have to go very far to see this. We can go throw a stone in a pool and watch it bounce off the wall. Okay, so reflection, dealing with reflection. Much of the wave energy that impacts the wall is reflected back into the lake and or down the shoreline, where it can combine with and enhance other waves. So this is just a natural phenomenon. If you create if you have a force going one way and you effectively stop the force, well, that energy has to go back. Equal and opposite forces, right? Physics 101. Now, physics maybe 202 is where they enhance the waves. So wave theory, there's something called harmonics in waves, and so if you and in sound, and which is a wave, and if you get waves to sync up versus come in conflict, so there's interference, and then there's I forget the word conference.
Operation or whatever.
Yeah, but when they sync up, then they're in harmony, and that's the harmonic. So wave energy, actually, a wave can grow higher if it's, it syncs up with another wave that's at that same frequency. And the classic example of this is that bridge across the Tacoma Narrows that wiped itself out because the wind blew at a certain frequency, and it just started oscillating that bridge, and eventually that bridge got into the harmonics of that of the frequency of the wind, and the whole bridge demolished. And if you haven't Googled that, Google that. It's an amazing video. So that deals with the reflection, which was a very vital correction. You know, it was just obviously a mistake in the document. And then they have the same comment about underneath, which I mentioned before, and then over top. So those are not changes. Those are just repeating of what they said about retaining walls originally. Okay, I think we're getting close to the end. Breaking waves and erosion tendency. So, excuse me. Because wave depth affects the amount of wave energy, that actually reaches the shoreline, the lake level can significantly affect the amount of energy available to drive the erosion process. Because the depth, just to repeat, affects the amount of wave energy that actually reaches the shoreline, the lake level can significantly affect the amount of energy available to drive the erosion process. The most significant energy dissipation occurs when the wave breaks. That's when it's dissipating, right? Dissipation, when it's breaking, which coinciding with the water depth less than about 1.25 times the wave height. For the range of predicted wave heights, this means that the full energy of waves will impact the shoreline when the nearshore depths are greater than a few feet. So this is referencing that wakeboard study that they enhanced on. So at the 0.8 foot, which was the original one, that wave is going to crash against the shoreline in shallower waters. If it's like a foot deep, it's going to start getting dissipated. So that the range, that's what they're talking about. That's the range. They're talking about that other scenario that they developed. As a result, and this is from page 43 of the document, as a result, holding the lake at a higher level during the periods of high natural or boat-induced wave activity will increase the tendency for erosion. So holding the lake level at a higher level during the natural wave energy that comes from the wind, because that's, one time that we're holding the lake, the summertime wave energy, or boat-induced, which is, again, summertime, will increase the tendency for erosion. Why? Because dissipating the energy is dissipated when the lake level isn't held at that level. Wave energy passes over the wave, over the sediment, if it's too deep. If it's shallower, it's going to break, and so then the energy is reduced, which is what drives erosion. It's that megawatts per linear foot that you're trying to reduce. And this is their bit on vegetation. Native vegetation along the shoreline provides increased habitat structure for fish and wildlife, contributes nutrients to the system, provides shade, traps sediment deposition due to waves and overland flow, traps and absorbs nutrients from upland soils, and is generally aesthetically pleasing, kind of statement. You know, nothing too groundbreaking there. But the challenges with native vegetation, are a grass carp, are inundation, and are wave energy. So that's the challenges of trying to get at this thing that is not only aesthetically pleasing, but provides fish habitat, shade, uses nutrients, provides nutrients, et cetera, those other statements there. So, in the absence of grass carp, page 40 here, plant establishment could conceivably be influenced by changes in water level. That is, recreational water levels could inundate and do inundate because you've created that. I mean, it's not like a could, it's a does, as we saw. Inundate the shoreline at a time that when they might otherwise be open to plant propagules that require saturated, wet, but not inundated sediment. Okay, so plants that are going to try to grow along the shoreline are going to require some moisture because they're not going to grow in the desert, right? They require some moisture, but they don't want to be sitting in standing water either because then they rot. That's the difference. So the period of recreational water level also corresponds to more sunshine, an increasing day length, which is important for plant establishment and growth, particularly seed germination and flowering. So these are just information there, pretty obvious. But what isn't maybe so obvious is the bit about plant propagules requiring wet but not inundated, and there's a difference. Oh, and then this comment here is that this non-native yellow flag iris, which you will see a lot of, competes well at a number of different levels of lake. We don't want yellow flag iris. It's not a native. It doesn't. It tends to clump up and break off too. It's one of those things you see floating along the shoreline often. But it competes pretty well in these kind of situations, regardless. So that's a comment that they provided. So recommendations and considerations. This document in this section, I think, really focuses on considerations. They only have a few recommendations, and it actually deals with projects such as our SOS program. But just as a summary, this is no surprise, this was in the previous. Predominant wind direction, wind speed, and fetch are major drivers of erosion. Major drivers, you know. Probably 80%, maybe up to maybe as low as 50%, you know, based on how much wakeboard energy you have. Wind matters. No surprise. But it's the wind speed and the fetch that are the drivers. So like when we talked about that summertime erosion window, the fetch was zero along that one border because the fetch was zero along that southern border because the wind hasn't even hit the water yet to start driving the wave. And then there's a comment in there, a consideration, that 10% of the winter time, and this gets at those extreme highs and extreme lows for the year, 10% of the winter, the lake level is above the ordinary high water. So nearly where we are today, well, we heard 10.3, the ordinary high would be 10.4. So in the wintertime, that sets up the greatest potential. So if you have a big storm or you have somebody who wants to go wakeboarding, this would be the time to create the greatest erosion when the lake's at the height because the water's up at the higher levels. So shoreline characteristics vary widely. That's pretty obvious. And that was the difficulty. And Tony, Dr. Pennington, made this very clear. It's very difficult to make assertions parcel by parcel. So some of this stuff comes down to generalizations, and we ask for that. Well, provide the generalizations then. Do that for us, because that was missing in the document.
So, Paul, how fast do these wind waves go?
How fast do the wind waves go? That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that specifically. They don't travel at 70 miles an hour, like the wind might. They tend to the wind is actually being slowed down by the water, and so it's actually exerting its energy onto the lake, which is taking some of that 70 mile an hour wind out of it, some of its steam out of it. So I don't know the exact how it would compete.
But isn't the amount of damage or the amount of impact that it has on the soil, isn't that a function of its speed, partially?
Yeah.
Its mass and its speed. I don't know.
Yeah. It is. And it actually becomes the wave height, because it's the wave height that is manipulated by the wind speed. And so the wave is, the water is pushing, being pressed upon by a force, the wind, and it's kind of swelling it up. And so that's how it translates into a wave. But that's the speed of that wave is not going to be the same speed as the wind wave, because water's heavy.
Yeah, well, do you know how heavy a wave is? I know that's a lot. How long is a rope?
Yeah. Heavy. A wave is heavy, yeah. Yeah, I mean, exactly.
You got 8 pounds, 40 miles an hour.
I see what you're getting at.
Probably take out that beam.
Yeah, it's a wallop, yeah. A pound of water is 8.34, or a gallon of water is 8.34 pounds. It's heavy. There's a reason that the lake wants to go flat again after the wind stops, because there's nothing to keep it up in the air. It's going to get, it's heavy. It just drops down. I mean, liquids, you know, form the basin that they're in. That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that specifically. The last couple things here, you know, coordinate with ODFNW and DSL for permits. It's just, you know, kind of a consideration. If you're, you know, doing something on the lake anytime, we do that anyhow. And then reduce the overland flow, which is runoff, to prevent erosion. So this is something that you can look at as well. Instead of just dealing with the lake, you can look at measures that would reduce the amount of erosion from runoff. And that would mean, you know, instead of having all your downspouts pointing in one direction and creating a little stream off your property, that's what we're talking about, runoff. You can dissipate that energy.
So you're not talking about Side Creek, where you have all that open dirt face that the water flows next to.
Yeah, no, this is, well, in order to reduce the erosion there, you'd want to reduce the amount of flow there. Yeah, so it's like stormwater management. You don't want to concentrate the flows, because when you concentrate them, you get a bigger pail of water coming down that's got more energy and it's got a higher velocity. So that's a consideration. Further, active shoreline restoration is recommended. Removal of invasives and replanting with native species. This is a good thing. This is something we want to do, something we're promoting already. Operational options that would lessen shoreline erosion. Operational options. Now, this means the dam. Operationally, the district, its options to lessen erosion are limited to an 18-inch section. But that 18 inches can be significant. If you have a wave that from their original stuff was 0.8 feet, and you allow 18 inches of water, then all of that wave energy, every bit of it, is going to go flow right through and hit that shoreline. And none of it's going to dissipate. If the wave is bigger, which they do get bigger, you know, whether they're wind or wakeboard, artificial ones, and it's deeper, again, 18 inches deeper, then, and you're got a 2-foot wave coming through, even that wave is only just going to begin to be getting dissipated by your extra 18 inches of water. So that's what that means, is operationally we're limited to this 18 inch realm, because we have a sill height of 8 feet and we have boards that stack up to 18 inches. relatively increased erosion seen in areas affected by summer winds. Now that gets out to that 1 foot figure that we saw that had the yellow on it. There's a relative increased amount of erosion seen in those areas that are affected by the summertime wind areas. And then, I think not surprisingly, there's more bank stabilization in areas that are affected by winter winds. Well, those properties were, you know, have walls and et cetera established because the winter waves have been, you know, there forever. I think what's new is a different lake level and more boating. Those are the parameters that are different, right? Those are the changes. You know, for the last thousands of years, the winds have been probably blowing from the southwest in the winter at peak time and in the summer from the north. Certainly in my lifetime and I'd say probably all of ours. Now, so what's different is the fact that we have elevated lake level. We've changed the hydrology of the lake. And there are more wakeboarders, too. 100 years ago, people weren't wakeboarding. So those things, I guess, aren't too surprising. And then boat wakes, are the most significant impact in sheltered areas. So in a cove where the wind doesn't have any fetch to pick up there's no wave. And so, therefore, if you go cutting cookies, that's where the wave energy would be. And that would make sense that in sheltered areas, your biggest impact would be from boat wakes. That's it. This is all available on the web, dlwid.org, under the projects page and erosion study. So if you want to review this more, it's all there, including the movie files and the inundation files, the aerials, this report, and this presentation. That's it.
Thank you, Paul. Comments, anyone?
I mean, the action that you need is to determine that the contract's complete and pay Tetra Tech, right?
Correct, yeah.
I'll move that, I would like you to check with Tetra Tech about what you think may be typos and determine if they are typos, because a couple of those things are important.
Mm-hmm.
We needed them to tell us in writing whether that's a typo or not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But subject, I don't see that needs to delay the decision that is complete and pay them, so I'll move that we do that. Pay Tetra Tech the full amount they're owed under the contract.
Second.
Further discussion? I just want to make sure that that in relation to that table that we get an understanding of how we can model the various mixes against those, you know, the original
mm-hmm.
2008 published study and the, you know, the assumptions based on variability of, you know, some of the different boats that are using the watershed. So if we can have some kind of equation that we can say, here's the mix that we'll put into that based on, you know, X number of, you know, percent wakeboard versus maybe, you know, ski versus whatever, you know.
Yeah,
so we can kind of just get an understanding of that. Or if you have,
well, I can ask if that's how they did it. I think they just picked a number of a larger wave. They picked one that was 0.8, which was the original. Then they said a foot.
Get the understanding of this,
yeah.
Right? What I just want to know is, you know, if those are all, you know, 100%, you know, examples in that table,
mm-hmm.
how can I make an example that says here's X percentage okay. of ski versus, you know, and then you can kind of think about how the wave energy variable, you know, is variable based on the mm-hmm. boat types that we see running around.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, and we can kind of take a little bit of that in consideration in understanding a little bit more about, you know, the 18-50%.
Right. Whether it's 20% of the wind or it's half, right.
But with a way to model some mm-hmm. of those. That in, you can get a little better understanding. That's all.
Yeah, I think we can ask that question, you know, and see what they say. You know, it really gets down to saying, well, if you have wakeboards, you know, at 100% of the time, and that's what all the simulation is, and that's creating that, I forgot what the number was, 2.4-foot wave on the shoreline 70 feet out, then you get 8,600 megawatts per linear foot, which equates to basically 95% of the total wave energy. So if, you know, to try to find out how, what it would be if we had 50% of the time we had this 0.8 wave, foot wave, and then 25% of the time we had this other one at 25, we could see if they could provide a little formula or something for that.
Well, yeah, I mean, irrespective of those percentages, we're looking for one equation, aren't we? Yeah.
It's just an equation that you can plug in the variability based on the table data that they give us.
Yeah. Yeah.
But see what that curve looks like.
Yeah.
Okay. Any additional discussion or comments?
I think I'd like to throw in one thing, and that is that there's a great gradation among wakeboard boats. I mean, your ski boat, you could make into a wakeboard boat by putting a tower on it. But that doesn't mean that it's going to create a great trough all of a sudden. There are wakeboard boats where you can put 1,000 pounds in one corner, fill a bladder, and get great depth. So
that's right. That extreme.
Yeah.
You know, treats each one as 100% of the boat. Do that.
Yeah, I agree.
So that's what I was being able to take and say, you know, on an average day, I might see three wakeboarders out or three wake surfers out there versus. Boats, right? Gives you the percentage of that extreme 8,600 pound megawatt foot
right.
wave that's happening instead of looking at it as a 100% whole. So.
So we have a motion, I think.
So we have a motion adopt or. Assume it's complete with the changes that we talked about, and go ahead and execute payment of the contract when those questions are answered. Favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries unanimously.
And I have a question. Can we go back for just a moment to? You said that there was a mistake, a misprint. They said that with the seawall there. That it is absorbed by that seawall. Watching the storms that we've had in the last couple of months, big waves coming in. I mean, even broke apart one of my docks. We have seawall virtually all along that, including the neighbor. And where does it go? Because it can't go over it. It hasn't gone over it. These waves that somehow increase in their power can increase the next wave, what have you. Where does it go? Why isn't it
some of it goes into destroying your dock, like you're saying, and destroying, and that's what it's trying to do. It's trying to get through that. Where it goes is it goes down and it goes along the shoreline. So if the angle of the wave comes in at, say, 20% to the shoreline, it's going to reflect at about a 20% angle as well. That's just the wave, like a reflection kind of thing. Part of that energy is going to go down, though, too. And that's why you often see undermining of walls, is because that wave energy is hitting and it's finding a point where it can't move right now. It's going to try again in about 2 seconds, but it's hitting that, and so some of it's going to go down and some of it's going to go along and away. So what that does is it creates a washout kind of sediment from around the wall. So the wall is actually being undermined by the energy. The wave energy is actually undermining it. So it's actually happening in the wintertime too, when you have the sediment is being hit. As it goes down, it's going to push that sediment out. You see what I mean? It's going to come in, it's going to hit, it's going to roll, and it's going to go down. So the sediment's going to come back out. And then you've got more exposed. And so that's where eventually that wave is going to go through. You know, I mean, that's you know, the end game. You know, rock walls and vertical abutments of all natures, you know, eventually do fail, you know, for one reason or another. You know.
Remember the new Carissa?
Yeah.
Brand new boat broken too.
Yeah.
I mean, just to be clear, though, you don't have, obviously, don't have 100% reflection of the wave energy. I mean, some of it is absorbed. Some of it's absorbed. You don't have, in other words, you'd have a, I mean,
it'd bounce
you'd have
back
a perfect, you have the perfect armor.
Wave's heavy. Water's heavy. So it's hitting, and then it's trying to create another wave against it. So there's actually a conflict of a wave. So then the waves are not in harmony, they're in conflict, there's interference of the waves. So that's why the wave energy may kind of just sit there and kind of bounce around as it's trying to go back out. There's another wave coming in that's actually impacting it. So it's causing a lot of static in there. If it was like, if you had a wave simulator and you just hit the shoreline, you would see that wave just ricochet back towards it, back out at that angle of incident that it came in. By and large, and then water's heavy, so water to keep that energy going requires more energy. Well, some of that energy is being used by gravity to pull that water back down, so that's why the water ends up flattening out long term, but doesn't in the near term.
Okay.
All right. So it looks like you've also asked for a decision on what we want to do from a dam installation perspective this month.
Yeah, I'd like to get your input, your direction on that. Typically, we put it in April 15th-ish, and then
for the last 2 years, we've left it open clear through May.
Correct. What we started is by putting in the stanchions, the metal stanchions.
So we put in the stanchions without the
right.
Okay.
And then I think we, you know, got some of the boards in, and then eventually we shut it all off. Yeah. And we, you know, we kept the lake level. You know, the reason we did that last year is we did not want to. We wanted to provide the researchers the optimal time to look at the water at the lake level, and they chose the low level. So we kept it as low as Mother Nature would let it, which it, you know, mid June was 9 feet, 8.9, or whatever it was those couple of few days.
Well, I think we have ample water in the lake right now. I really can't see it being a problem this year, but that's just my viewpoint.
I guess, you know, it doesn't really make any difference. I know that Bill doesn't want to get out there when there's 3 feet of water going over the...
Yeah, and I wouldn't ask him to. There's always been a... you know, caveat in that April 15th date. It's when it's safe. On our new sign that we got printed up, there's a picture at the top of those three of Steve Hoover, who was our lake contractor before. And you know, if it's a going above his wader, it was too deep, and that was the limit there.
Does anybody have any issue with waiting until May to put it in?
I don't.
No.
Okay, let's just go ahead and wait till May.
Okay. I'll get your feedback and we'll go from there.
Anything additional on the erosion study? Communications report. Okay.
It's interest of time, though. I don't want to take up too much of your time all night here. So we are here. I just wanted to announce to the public provide an image to reflect on. You will receive this document in your mailbox. We received it in the district's document mailbox today. The cover sheet of this Oregon Coast Community College 25. And anniversary celebration of 25 years of Oregon Coast Community College. It's a tribute to Dr. Pat O'Connor in many ways. But what they've done is they put together 25 classes, and we are actually going to be teaching one of those classes. And they're community education classes. They're $25, and the class that we're putting on is understanding local water quality, be part of the solution. And I see a familiar-looking face up here that's going to be giving a talk here, Alex Ward, who's on our budget committee, safe hiring practices and background screen. And there's yoga, and there's just all sorts of things. But I just wanted to point that out. So look for this document, 25 years, and then you can go to the website, Oregon Coast Community College SharkNet there, and sign up for these today. And our class is going to be open to up to 12 participants. And it's going to be one day. I think it's May 23rd at the North Campus from 6 to 8:50. So I think that it's an opportunity for people to learn about what the water quality parameters that we measure and how we do it and that sort of thing. And I think it should be pretty fun. So what else do we have? Just a reference that the Good Morning Wake Up Show at KBCH, Seth was on last month. I'll be on this month. Generally, there's podcasts of that presentation available through kbcham.com. You can get those. And we just have a standing interview time on the Tuesday following our meeting, second Tuesday of the month. Also, last month, we had an interview with Bruce Koike, who is the interim Oregon Coast Community College president, on OCC On the Air. So we had that, which was on KMPT and Walport Station and KBCH. And then lastly, and this is why I wanted the slide up here again, is we just released, Seth released, I should say, might have had about 2 cents worth on this, so thank him for this, the spring edition of the Clearwater e-newsletter. And I just applaud him for the work they put into this. It's a lot of work that goes into these things. But the beauty of it is the publications are cheap. You know, it gets online, we pay for the service, and you can sign up for this service very simply by going to our website. And if you go to the website, dlwid.org, and you go to this section right here, if people are seeing this at home, I don't know if they are, it's on the screen, but it says join our email list. Just type in your email and hit join. And then you'll get an option to either sign up for the water quality, to the quarterly newsletter, which was that document, and or the meeting, monthly meeting minutes. So if you're just interested in kind of the kind of cool information the quarterly newsletter, then click that one. If you want just water quality, then click that, and that'll come start showing up in your mailbox when we start the water quality season in May. And if you want the meeting minutes, click the other one, and you'll get that too. And you can click all three of them. And if you've signed up with us and you want to change your thing, you can just go to the same website here, type in your email, and hit join again, and it'll send you a link to that you'll have to click to then go and change your passwords or whatever you need to do. If you've changed your address or you want the water quality stuff too, whatever you want to do. So you can customize your subscription to this e-newsletter just by going to our website. And that's it. One of these days I think I'd like to walk us through the website so people can see that, but we'll do that a different day.
So safety report, looks like there's no incidents.
Yeah. In Coast TMD.
How about TDML study? It's getting ready to kick off.
Okay, yeah. So just briefly, this Mid-Coast TMDL process, we had our kickoff meeting a few weeks ago. There'll be the second one. I think it's the third Wednesday of the month, and they're going to be held up and down the coast in the Mid-Coast. So we'll have probably one up north here, and there's going to be one down in Florence, et cetera. And it's, you know, this is kind of a long process, 18 to 24-month process, where they're looking at this idea of the total maximum daily load, TMDL, for the whole Mid-Coast basin. And there's a number of individuals that are participating, and I provided you some information relative to who's in attendance and kind of what to expect. There will be information that they will post to their website, and we provide the link in our document, and we'll we'll get a link up on our website too, to help people follow that along, just a hot link to go directly to that, and so people can participate and learn about the process. Any other questions? We talked about this last meeting quite a bit.
Do you have anything on our website for the our partnership in the TDML study? Or
we haven't set anything up yet. I've actually been waiting for them to kind of get their website a little bit more up to spec so that there was actually more to it, and just time. I just haven't had the time to dedicate to this. But we will be addressing this in the very near future. We can get our website to cooperate. We've had some upload issues, email issues all week. It's been kind of a nightmare. But when that's cooperating, this will be an easy thing to add.
You want to pull the glossary up while you're there?
I'm sorry?
Glossary.
Oh, glossary. So this we actually did add to the website. If you go to the research page, you can... And this is live, I think. So, research page. Ask me later. There it is. It's right here. Glossary of terms. Okay. And it's of the terms that I had in there. I think I'm about 95% of completion. I just went ahead and posted it because I didn't want to delay. I was maybe 75% earlier, but I wanted to. And so if there are other terms, though, there's stuff that develops. And in fact, this TMDL process is a perfect opportunity to tweak this and to provide, you know, a one-stop shopping for a glossary of terms relative to Devil's Lake. Basically, all of these documents are live on the web here, too. And people can click on these. And, you know, some of it gets pretty technical. And so this glossary will help to weed through it. And this goes back. This is a substantial effort that we've put in to get this all these documents in one place. From 1947, aquatic weed problems in Oregon. If that doesn't just tell you that we're not in new waters, these are old waters we're in.
Okay.
But, yeah, so this is all available on the research page of the website.
Questions, yes? How about the internship?
We've had a number of applicants so far. The cutoff period is April 14th. People can actually download a... what was that? They can actually download a copy of the internship offering from the website, too. It's right on the homepage there.
And when do you... when do you anticipate having some recommendations for the board? Is that going to be the May meeting? Or
I anticipate the May meeting.
Okay.
That's my goal. You know, we've got to try to organize some interview times. We've got to deal with the budget process now. But there's some people that actually could start as early as mid-May by virtue of their course load, semester versus quarters. So, yeah, that's the goal, May. And we've got some really talented individuals interested in this program. Exceptional, all the way from as far away as New Hampshire. Yeah.
So, if you want to just let us know, maybe when you're doing the interviews, it might, you know, in case one of us wants to join in or, you know, meet some of these folks ahead of time. Thing to do. New business, Devil's Lake Revival. Seth?
Yes, sir. So I think everyone remembers the Devil's Lake Revival. Grass Card Festival had been going on around Devil's Lake. We brought that back with a similar idea called the Devil's Lake Revival. It included pontoon boat tours, kayak tours, stand-up paddleboard demos, sailing race, music, a bunch of informational booths. We had a lot of activities for children. And we also had a raffle, which included a grand prize for a kayak and all the accessories of that kayak. So this is just on the agenda. The question is, do we want to hold this festival again this year? And if so, if we want to choose a date for it, there's some talk of moving it a little bit further up as opposed to late August. So I attached a calendar there. I've talked with the city. I've talked with the casino to see weekends that there might be conflicting events going on. So really, you know, if you guys choose that you want to do this again, the cost last year was about $3,000. I assume it should be right in that window again. And as far as the calendar goes, you know, there's 13 Saturdays, but they fill up really quickly. So as I was looking, you know, if we want to go past June, there's really only one weekend in July. And then for August, there's two. And I thought if we wanted to move it up a little bit, August 4th to me seemed like the best Saturday to do it if we so choose. That's really up to you guys.
Is there anything we need to do to reserve the date?
The park right now is open. So, but yeah, we would need to reserve it. And the earlier we do that, the better. I talked with Gail Kimberling, who's responsible for doing reservations, and she said by May is like when people really start planning for the summer.
I think the 4th of July is probably the best.
Yeah.
Yep.
Better chance of the lake being in pretty good shape than later.
I move we hold the Devil's Lake Revival on August 4th, 2012.
Second. Further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Fourth it is.
If you want, I think I can probably talk to this in the meantime if we want to keep going, if not. So basically, the city of Lincoln City is looking at redoing their comp plan every so many years. You have to do a revision to your comp plan. It's called periodic review. So they're going to be looking at that again. So we basically, Paul attended that initial meeting just to see what the direction of that was going to be. And I think as they move forward, the suggestion is basically that I spend some time staying up to date with that. And as they start making changes to it, just be continually giving input into things that we would like to see and things that matter for Devil's Lake.
Okay.
Is the comprehensive plan on the city's website?
I would assume so, but I'm not 100% sure. But most cities, I mean, it's a kind of a big document for them, so I would think it would be.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, let's skip the water quality, and we'll go down to riparian wetlands protection. Go back to Paul's
stuff. Sure. What's that, riparian map?
Yeah.
Just going to pull up a map, actually, that's on our website as well. We'll pull up the...
So we just had some questions about development around Devil's Lake, specifically in overlay zones. So I just kind of provided a little bit of background issue on this, and hopefully this will address some questions. If there's more information that you'd like, you can let me know after this. But basically, I think everyone's pretty aware of zoning. You know, the city has recreation zones, they have residential zones, industrial zones, commercial zones, and then a lot of kind of mixes of those and other restraints. One of the things you can have in addition to just your regular zone is an overlay zone. An overlay zone is it's a zone or district created by a local legislature or city for the purpose of conserving natural resources or promoting certain types of development. And an overlay zone overlays another zone. So you can have a recreational zone, then you can add another overlay zone over it that would make more stringent requirements or less stringent requirements. So in this case, what we're talking about is a wetland overlay zone, which requires there's additional restrictions if you're going to develop in that area. So on the map there, you can see that's for the city, basically, kind of where we have those places. So if you, I guess the first thing to say is that we have a significant wetland, which is a state designation. So you can see on the map, it shows where the significant wetlands are. One thing to keep in mind with those is that those are kind of rough ideas of where significant wetlands are. No one has gone to every site on that zone, done a wetland delineation, and said, this is where a wetland is. It's somewhat similar to a soil survey. You know, they check it in different places, and they have a general idea that this is potentially a place where you could have these significant wetland zones. So if you want to develop in those or do anything in those, then you're required to go and get that wetland delineation. So it's at that point, once you want to do something to a specific part, which in that overlay zone, then you have to prove that this area, in fact, isn't a significant wetland, so you should be allowed to develop the area. So when it comes to developing in these areas around the lake that are in an overlay zone, and we have two, we have a riparian overlay zone and we have a wetland overlay zone. The wetland follows more like state guidelines. The riparian is a little bit more localized. So it, again, just as I was saying, like the questions that came up was about development in these areas, and that's the process that I just kind of explained is what you'd go through. So say, you know, Kip owns a property on the lake, he wants to develop it. He would go, he'd get a wetland delineation on that property. He then submits that to the city. He submits it to the Department of State Lands. And it's up to them then to say, like, yes, this wetland delineation is approved or not approved. And if it's shown that there's parts of that property that aren't wetland, and for that it's a matter of vegetation that's on the property, it's a matter of hydrology, and it's a matter of soil types. So those are the three things that you have that actually create a wetland. One thing to point out, though, is that with the wetlands, there actually are that criteria. For the city with the riparian areas, there isn't really a criteria. They don't have, there's not like these specific check boxes to say this is a riparian zone. They just define it as that transition area between a wet area to an upland area. And I think they talk about like streams and lakes. So then, the question kind of became, is there anything in addition to this that the district can do so that we find out about development that potentially is happening in overlay zones? And, there's a few things that we've done already. The first is we just went to the city and we just said, if someone is puts in an application to do work in that area, will you just notify us? So that's the first thing we can do, is at least review if there's going to be work being done in those areas. And then also, some other things that we could do is, without things we could do tomorrow, basically. The second one is just creating an informational brochure or a little bit of paperwork, not so much paperwork, just information that we could ask the city if they'd be willing to give to property owners who are going to be doing shoreline development. So say you have a house, you're going to do shoreline development. We could say something about low-impact development, stormwater treatment, or really just about protecting the vegetation that's currently there, or if you're going to be stripping vegetation to replant that, or things like that. And if we want to go a step further, we could look at like doing ordinances and things like that. And the big thing would be really to be protecting like native vegetation, wetland areas. So there's a few ways that we could do that. One would be through the landscaping ordinance, adding additional requirements in the landscaping ordinance. We could look at these natural resource overlay zones that they have and try to make specific changes to that regarding Devil's Lake. And then finally, the only thing about doing that, though, is that it's still, that's just in the city. These are just city ordinances in the county. It doesn't sound like they've been like really following these as strictly. So I don't know if that's exactly what you guys were looking for in this kind of update. It was just sort of asked to be put on the agenda. If you have any other specific questions, I'd be happy to answer them or look into them and bring them back to you. And then as far as those potential actions go, if giving some information to the city that they could distribute to property owners when they want to develop, if that's something that's interesting for you guys to do, we can certainly do that.
What's the normal time frame when you get a notification of a proposal to develop property that involves wetlands? How much time do you have to comment? Do you know?
What's the comment period after, like after they submit their paperwork?
If we get a notification, then how much time do we have to comment?
I don't know that offhand.
At the state level, there's a couple things that come into this. If the first part, which Seth was talking about, is whether or not you have a wetland on your property and whether or not you have to comply with the wetland removal fill laws, and that's where the delineation comes in. Now, that delineation process is pretty much internal, as far as I understand, with the state and the private property owner. where it becomes external is when there is a wetland determined, and then there's a project that they still want to go forward with. And that process, that removal fill process, which is the state one, which is a little different than what the city we're talking about, but it's one of the processes that you can participate in. I believe it's like a 30-day comment period on any like removal fill project. And there's a way for us and anyone else to get notified of those things. I think you just sign up with the State Department of State Lands, and you can get an email by county. So it's a little bit more customized than some of these other announcement listservs you might find yourselves on. But that doesn't talk about the city one.
I just wanted to interject here that years ago, the city, we passed a bond measure. It's $3-point-some-odd million, I believe. And it was a fund set up to purchase things such as lands, wetlands, etc., that we wanted
space
to protect. Right. And as a matter of fact, there is a development just beyond my fence line where there's a house being built. And then beyond that is an area that the city purchased from that fellow that's developing that house with funds, I believe, from that. I think it was $150,000. So they do have the money, or did have the money at least, and why they didn't purchase that land when it became available, I don't know, because it was on the MLS, but they weren't looking for it, I guess, and so someone else bought it and made use of it. So there may be some funds that you could, that could be another answer as to, instead of someone developing something, why the city could offer to buy it.
Uh-huh.
And after all, they've done it before many times.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. I think, of that $3-whatever million, I think there's around $1 million left. I mean, I'm just guessing. In fact, I've had some contact with the city about open space, as to who's their contact, because Ron Plover used to be their contact, right. And he's retired, and now the senior planner plays a role, as well as the public works director. It's kind of broken off into two bits. But there's interest on the Lincoln Land Legacy Program, which is the program that I sit on with the county, with the monies that they have to maybe collaborate with the open space monies and the group up here, mm-hmm. to find parcels that could be purchased or easements acquired on and that sort of thing. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is, you know, a fundamental tool to protecting wetlands is just acquisition, and that's been a real tool in Devil's Lake's watershed.
You're saying we have already requested to be on the city's notification list for when an application to develop in a wetland riparian overlay zone is submitted?
Yeah, and we've been added to that list.
And I thought we did that a long time ago, didn't we? Or was that just recently?
We've always been on their, I forget the term,
the DSL
site plan reviews, which are only larger projects. So a project within the city limits that might go under site plan review is like a plan unit development. Like Bi-Mart had a site plan review, larger things. A single parcel would likely not go under a site plan review, like a one development. So the mechanism isn't the same. So this notification would be different than what we were receiving for site plan review. So it's a step forward.
I think we should be on this list, and you say that we are. And when we get a notification, we should go out and look at it. And, you know, you guys are, I think, very good at evaluating that kind of stuff. Write your comments and send them in. I mean, I think it should have an impact. If you can only do it on a case by case basis. I think I don't. Until we know, I don't know. I don't know about how we can specifically influence the city to add additional requirements. I don't know what those would be. I mean, I think the law is already strong enough and needs to be enforced, and we go out and look at it. I mean, we could have a hand in that if it's, you know. I think this stuff goes unenforced more than we realize.
Yeah, and bringing the awareness is just the first step. And so by even having this discussion here in a public meeting is important. You know, it's raising the awareness. So if, you know, things are slipping through the cracks, then, you know, I think having at least, you know, that email come to us where we can look at the, you know, be part of that process is a huge step and would, you know, help with enforcement because there's eyes on the project. A similar example might be a parcel that was there was some logging that was being proposed in the urban growth boundary. I think you might remember that, and a lot of eyes kind of looked at that. Now ODF, Oregon Department of Forestry, would have been the one entity to administer that. Well, it may have slipped through their cracks if there weren't other local eyes on that parcel. So our local eyes on the city is kind of would be similar, you know, to that, I think.
Just, you know, don't take it to a draconian extreme. I mean, try and be helpful to the property owner who wants to do something, but be mindful of the watershed at the same time. Anything else?
No.
Okay, so water.
Thank you. So harmful algal blooms surveillance program, and the toxin analysis. I attended a conference or a meeting of the stakeholder group that the Oregon Health Authority identified down there. Their meeting was held down at Lane Community College earlier in the previous month, I guess. And the state has provided some updates to their health advisory guidelines, which are broken down in parts in the document here that you have in front of you, which the full document links are available on their website. The big thing for Devil's Lake, the only change that's relevant to us, is instead of requiring toxin monitoring of anatoxin A and microcystin, two algal toxins, they are now requiring toxin monitoring of up to four toxins, depending on the blue-green algae that you have present in your lake. So if you get a bloom of toxic blue-green algae, right, that is a known producer of anatoxin, then you need to be monitoring for that. You don't need to monitor for the other three. If you get a toxic bloom of a different cyanobacteria algae or blue-green algae that produces, say, microcystin, then you want to be monitoring that, and you're not required to monitor for the others. Does that make sense? So what our program does currently is we take an approach of doing visual inspections. We take grab samples, composite grab samples of the shoreline in a number of different places. You can see all those spots on the web there on our water quality page, and analyze some of those for the types of cyanobacteria, blue-green algae, that are present. That way we can identify which toxins then are likely. But we take a proactive approach in monitoring one of the toxins, microcystin, because we can do it cheaply and we can do it in-house. And this is a strategy that we've had for about 4 years now. Last year, when they had the anatoxin requirement in there, it was, you know, it's not a toxin that we can monitor in-house. So we had looked on the commercial market for labs to do that. And generally, it's about $250 to $350 for an anatoxin sample, one sample. We can do microcystin samples for maybe $25 plus labor. You know, I mean, it's a significant difference of doing it in-house than having to send it a field. The other two toxins, there are kits as well. And I say kits, I mean the you buy these kits for about $500, and one's for microcystin, and one's for saxitoxin, and one's for splendospermopsin, and you'd have to have all three on the shelf if you had a toxin that if you needed to monitor for all three. And we could do that to get at the other two that may or may not we may have to sample for. But what I've been able to find, and it's just an option that's available to us, is by partnering with King County in Washington. They have a laboratory set up where they're getting samples from all over Washington State, and so they've really ramped up their program in Washington, and they're getting samples all the time. So they can do it more efficiently because they know they're getting samples from Lake Steilacoom and all the water bodies up around the Puget Sound area and Seattle, et cetera. So that lab has offered to public entities an opportunity to basically hire them to do analysis. Now if we had a bloom of toxic cyanobacteria blue-green algae that was a producer of antitoxin, we'd have to go out and farm this out anyhow. So it's a good connection to make. So just by that alone, I would recommend that we get into an agreement with them to allow us to do this.
See that type of green algae?
That produces antitoxin? Yes. Yeah. The predominant one is called Anabina that we see. It's fairly common in Devil's Lake. It tends to be show up after our big Gloetrichia bloom. Now we're talking like very specific genus level of these organisms. So, I understand if this gets confusing, but there's actually a slide, and I could throw it up on the web too, or up on the screen if you wanted to look at. It's this one here that shows. I have it on the big screen.
So the two primary are the Anabina and the Gloetrichia. See? I got them circled so you can see the different toxin types.
Oh, I guess I didn't include that one. I apologize. Those are just two examples because they are ones that we do see. There's Anabina, which is a producer of microcystin, Splendospermopsin, antitoxin A, and saxitoxin. So it's all four. It's like the nastiest of them all. There's another one that's probably nearly as nasty called Anaphanizomenin, which produces three out of the four. What it doesn't produce is microcystin. So if we had a bloom of that, our own internal stuff as we do it would miss it. We wouldn't have a toxicity measure. We get a zero because it's not a producer of that, but it might get a hit on ones that it is producing. Gloetrichia, which is the very common, and people can see this in the it's like a pom pom. It's like the size of a pin head, and it looks like a pom pom under the microscope. You can actually see it pretty well in the water, and it accumulates in mass, and that's why it becomes a bloom. That organism is a weak microcystin producer. It's a weak one. It's not a very proficient. It's not very good at producing toxins, which is good for us, right? So when we get a bloom of that, it might look pea soup out there, but it might not be very toxic. And that's why we went to the toxin monitoring program. So we would actually monitor the toxins and not just rely on the cell counts. Because the cell counts could give you would suggest that you were in a really bad situation and you might not be. So by virtue of having to potentially sample for these other toxins, I'd like the district to join in with King County and sign a contract for the opportunity, not the actual contract to actually fundamentally have to submit samples to them, but the opportunity to submit samples to them at the price sheet provided in your packet. Which is considerable savings. I mean, I talked about.
So you're talking about sending like all 12 sample sites up and
no,
12
no.
times the money on each one of these?
No, that's a good question. What I would reserve this four is for delisting the lake. Okay, not to list it, but to delist it. And the reason I say that is that we already have ways of listing the lake, and that's through Microcystin, which we monitor in-house, and the cell counts. So if either one of those pushes into a listing, and we have to then monitor, we have to try to delist it, well, the cheapest thing to do is wait. And that's what you do. You wait. You know, you wait. You're not going to go sending a bunch of samples in, which you kind of, you know, your cell counts are still too high anyhow, so you wait. When you get the cell counts down and it's feasible, it's reasonable to accept, to believe that the concentrations of any toxins that may or may not be present have also then come down, that's when you confirm that with the state lab or the county lab.
So you're looking at this as a means to get off the list quicker than normal.
Right.
Start seeing indicators.
But also just a way to get off the list, period. If you're on the list for an organism that produces a toxin that you're not actually able to monitor internally. So you kind of have to be able to provide the answer for antitoxin. That's the big one that started this whole ball rolling. You have to be able to show that that level is below 20 parts per billion to get off the list. Now, this is also a change that the state made. So last year, they had two toxins to monitor. One was Microcystin, which we monitor. One was antitoxin A, which we don't monitor. To get off the antitoxin A list, you just had to show that it wasn't even in there at all. It's zero, non-detect. Well, things are pretty sophisticated. You can detect very minuscule amounts of these toxins. And so the state actually put a threshold that as long as you're under this new threshold, this 20, then you are off the list, if that makes sense. So the recreational guideline is 20 parts per billion. Also shown here is milligrams per liter. Now, you're familiar with the 8 parts per billion because that's the one that we've been working with for 4 years now, of Microcystin. And then they also put in guidance lines for the Clindospermopsin, which is the 6 parts per million, and the Saxitoxin, which is 100. And these numbers may change as they develop more information about how this program works. They get more information. They're perfectly willing to move these up and down and whichever way is appropriate. But currently, they're slated at 20 for the antitoxin A, so versus just a detection, which is good. So instead of just having it show up and be listed until it all goes away and you can't detect it anymore, they have a number that you can at least get underneath of that threshold.
So I have a question. You talked about it getting us off the list faster. But I see in their price sheet it says final data in 14 days once they get it. So aren't most of your advisories lifted before that time once it's looking like it's receding?
Well, if you get listed, you have to show that the toxin's not present at 20 parts per billion. That's the requirement. So it's not just that it looks like it's receding. You have to show that it's receding. Now, the 14-day turnaround is to get the final paperwork. Okay. They're committed to getting an email out as soon as they can get the data back.
My second question was, we're a government agency, or a government-funded agency for this lake, and we're the only one in Oregon. How is this stuff being funded for all these other lakes?
That's a good question. Basically, what the guidelines provide is basically if it's a lake that you're kind of quasi in control of, then you are kind of the designated management agency. Now, those would be for the state of Oregon, say the U.S. Forest Service. They've got a number of lakes that they have under their proviso. The Army Corps of Engineers also have a number of reservoirs that they manage, and so that's then their jurisdiction.
Okay.
So that's where most of it is lying, is in other entities. Now, I spoke about this a long time ago, but the state of Washington also has a program And this is that King County program where all those things go to. So the state of Oregon is actually funding their, I mean, the state of Washington is funding their program, which is pretty nice.
So have we had a, we have not had an Anabena during the water season, have we?
Yes, we have. Okay. Just not last year or the year before.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
So what you're looking for is toxin testing through the King Lab, King County Lab,
mm-hmm.
as needed for analysis of toxins that we are not capable of testing in-house.
Correct.
To be able to get off the list.
For delisting, right.
Delisting.
And
well, I was going to as needed part.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. Exactly. And there is... I did mention that there are some kits that we could buy for two of the other four toxins, this cylindospermopsin and saxitoxin. Now, if we need to delist and it's a $500 test kit for both of those, there's $1,000. We might use it. It might use it up, or it sits on the shelf and expires in that by the next year. If that was the case, there might be some consideration to do those two toxins if need be, because hopefully we won't be testing for those externally too at like $200 a pop versus say maybe 20 to 50 plus staff time. So it just depends on what's the best use of the district's time and money. And that's where I would hope to leave it and make those decisions.
So on the samples, are you just planning on sending it?
Yeah. So it would basically be limited to a couple samples. And that's why it's going to be like when we know the bloom's going away. And we all of our visual indications show that it's going away. It's not hugging along the shoreline. If we get into a situation where we have Anabena along the shoreline and the rest of the lake is looking fine, well, we may have to show that we can't delist the lake 100%, but we've got some good data for you here at Sandpoint and say at Regatta Grounds. And that could then be more money than what would be anticipated. But that's where I think we'd have to just bite the bullet, because what we wouldn't be able to show the state is a delisting unless the whole lake is delisted. So they're not comfortable saying, oh, well, one tenth of it is fine or nine tenths. They don't have that kind of oversight kind of to say, well, local conditions suggest that if you stay out of that cove, you're okay.
So if I get it, what you're saying is that if you have a detection at two locations, you'll send a sample from each location. If it's three locations, you'll send three samples.
That would be the optimal.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's
that,
really to delist.
One test or three tests?
That's three tests.
That would be up to three right there.
Yeah.
But, I tried to, put a cap on this because we do have limited resources, and if we therefore only budget and look at the resources we have to delist and what that might equate to, we'll spend the money at that point, but not try to delist too early to maybe run out of money. I mean, if you end up like you're gonna have to spend another couple $100 in another couple weeks, But it does make sense to delist as soon as possible. So it's these things run their courses. They run their course, and hopefully they end. But you do get secondary blooms, too. I mean, that does happen. You get a late reoccurrence bloom. In fact, what we've seen is we get a Gloetrichia bloom, say, July, August, which is that pin drop one I was telling you about, the pom-pom. And then that recedes and dies off. And then Anabena shows up, because when the Gloetrichia died off, all of its nutrients that it was holding within its own cell is released. And so algae likes to use nutrients up, and so something else takes its place and blooms and runs its course. And that's something you definitely see.
What's the turnaround time likely to be?
For the samples?
Yeah. You take a sample, how long before we get an answer?
You know, I don't honestly know that specifically, but I'm thinking it's a couple days, tops. We have to mail it to
them. How do you get it there? You mail it to them.
Yeah, I mean, that's mail it. It's like an overnight. It's a, there's some shipping costs that aren't part of this agreement opportunity. We're not, you know, the agreement that I shared with you guys and those prices don't include the shipping.
Sure.
But, and that's why, you want to keep the samples down, too.
So, yeah, I had to write this one down. I'll move that we authorize our manager to sign an agreement with King County Lab to spend up to $3,000 annually for toxin testing as needed. For analysis of toxins, we are not capable of testing in-house.
Do you have a second? Yeah, I'll second. All right. Further discussion? All those in favor?
Actually,
aye. Yes, in discussion?
Beat the bill. My question would be, in the last 2 years, would we have had to mail off any samples?
No.
Okay. Aye.
Aye.
That would be unanimous.
Thank you. Okay.
So, signage? I think you had some questions about signage.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. So, we asked for eight of those permanent signs that the state had. We got those. As it stands right now, my direction is to hold on to those and not put those up in favor of the signs that we developed. So without any further directions, that's the way we'll operate. And also, there was the poster that they developed, which I think we had some really good input that we shared with them, that it came from this board that I gave back to them about how that poster looked. And it said harmful algae at the top, you know, if you remember it.
Yes.
They took that under advisement, and they're redoing their sign. And we haven't seen it yet, the poster, I mean. But I think that they're going to take that in consideration. And I think it will make a better convey what they hopefully are wanting to convey, information, and not a scare thing when there may not be effect, because that poster would be up year round, similar to our green poster. It's just there for information. So we haven't seen that yet, but I think eventually, if it comes out and it seems like something the district wants to use, that's the direction that we'd go. We'd try to uniform with the state, use their green poster, and then potentially their permanent signage. So that being said, we don't have any changes unless directed. So I'll let you guys decide on that, which if you want to provide direction. But regardless, we have our yellow sign and our E. coli sign, so just away from the HABS surveillance program. Those are postings that we put out each week, more or less. And those signs are getting weathered and tattered, and I'd like to just get a whole new clean set of those that we can have on the shelf, painted, cleaned up, ready to put out, and then rehab the old ones as best as we can and have those as backup. So there's a request for about $1,000, $859 or so, to get a whole new set of those signs available, made up and available.
So I guess I'm saying you want to create a new set and then rehab the old set. Why can't we just take the old set down, rehab it, and put them back up?
Well, we can, and that's what we've done in the past.
Why would I want to spend $444 on a second set of signs if I can rehab the existing ones before the season starts?
Yeah, and this what we don't have is any like replacements in the mix.
Have we ever needed one?
If one gets vandalized, which happens. So yes, we have. We've had to, refit one. What this would streamline would just be that process, and also like instead of like going out in April and pulling all the signs down, we can send one contractor out there with the new signs, put the new ones up, take the old ones down, put the new ones up, and be done. It just kind of simplifies that process too. So it's just kind of having that reserve of resources, and then they can take the old ones back down, service those, make sure those are cleaned up and ready to go for the following year. So it's just a way of doing it. You could do either way.
So
go ahead. Do you know what it's going to cost to rehab them, and have they discussed this with you, how difficult that is, or is it like making a new one?
It's like making a new one. It's like taking off the plastic. The plastic generally has to be recycled, because it gets cracked and faded by the sun. But they've lasted, a few years, most of them. This, I think, is just an opportunity to get a fresh look. And the reason I definitely would like to make sure that, and I know I'm sure everyone else wants to make sure that's a good, clean look out there, is because that reflects on the water quality program,
yes,
generally, yeah. And so that's as far as, I think your question was about time and to rehab. You have to, repaint them, clean them up, repaint them, let them dry, put the plastic on them again, get the new plastic. There's a rehab cost regardless. What this would be just new metal signs and then also new plastics for all the signs. And then the old metal would be, by and large, just repainted. There might be one or two that are bent or something that don't make it feasible to use, but hopefully not.
You're talking about the water quality signs you're putting on the kiosks and stuff?
Yep.
Like at Regatta Grounds?
Yep.
I walked by one of those the other day and I was looking at it. Seem to be in fair shape to me.
Yeah, and many of them are in pretty good shape. This is just a request. Okay. It's up to you to whether or not you want to spend the money. We do need to pull them down to clean them up, and some of them need to be replaced or repaired. So it's just kind of, I don't know. I just thought about the time and energy that it takes them to drive out there, take the sign down, fix it, then drive back out there and place it. And then that seemed to be kind of a redundancy that we could eliminate.
Is this our contracted contractor?
Yeah.
He's already being paid for part of this, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a different way of looking at it. So
I think an as-needed approach, if any. If you said the signs are still looking pretty good, I don't see why we'd even need to do this. I don't know.
Well, how many new ones were you asking for?
12, I think, is. 24, because there's 12 of each. There's 12 sites, and there's two of each, sorry.
So there's probably not much difference between having 24 done or 6 done. 6 replacements, for instance, where and if needed.
Well, I mean, it is a per-unit price.
Per unit?
Yeah, it is per-unit.
You could have just a few to take the place of what's really, vandalized.
I would agree. Absolutely. With that. Just replace as needed.
Yeah. Get maybe half dozen or at least 3 of the yellow and 3 of the blue or what have you. Because we have the blue and the yellow. That's what we're talking about. The blue is the one for the E. coli. The yellow is the part of the HABS program, the yellow one. That we could do too. This was just like, that was my original thought, and I thought, well, why don't we talk to the board about just having a whole replacement set? That's where my thinking came in. It wasn't like, I want to go spend $898, because I took time to figure out how much it would cost to do any. That was just an effort that need not happen if it, but because we had to find out what it would cost to do one, this is just a cost to do 24.
I like that idea. See what we really need.
That's going to be a little late.
Okay.
In the game, just as enough, because it's already...
I'll make a motion that we authorize up to $300 for needed repair and replacement of current signage.
I second that.
Further discussion?
Is that going to be enough?
I think, by and large, there's going to be the plastics they're going to have to come off of. If we replace all the plastics... it's about a $7.50 piece, so that's gotten into $150 pretty quick. And that's generally where the repair is. I mean, the metal, just to have the metal backing is nice, because then if you have a real thing, you just put the whole thing up, you're done, you're clean.
It just seems to me, Paul, just routine maintenance.
Well, if we go with the $300 budget for you, you're basically going to replace all the signs within 3 years anyway. By 3 years, if we do that every 3 years.
Right.
I mean, 300 every year, you would have them all replaced. It just seems kind of a waste of money to go out and replace a bunch of them.
Well, it would just be to have a backup, frankly. I mean, you're creating more backup or less backup or no backup. Right now we're at no backup.
You need 24 backups, though?
Only if you want to just swap them all out. I mean, I think it's pretty clear what...
Okay, so we have a motion on the table for $300. Any further discussion? In favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carries unanimously. Okay, we need to revisit the financial report, Paul. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So the reason to take that out of the consent agenda is because I scheduled three payments of varying totals to get the total, whatever the balance of their $28,000 contract was. And the reason I had to do three payments is because I think we have a $10,000 limit per transaction. So that's on that financial, the proposed financial report. And so if those which have been now approved and there's no other concerns about the financial report, I think you could make a motion to adopt that.
I'll make a motion that we adopt the financial report.
Second.
Further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay, motion carries unanimously. Non-agenda items. Okay. I will go down to public comment.
One of these days you'll actually do something, I say. We'll see. But the non-agenda item, I guess, would be trying to revisit the boat wake thing. I'm kind of concerned that you've got a public document out there that vilifies wakeboarders in a way that is untrue. I mean, if you read through the report, so it does get back to the report, for those who want to look at it objectively, there's some key things in there that Dr. Pennington put in to make sure you could identify where it wasn't her information. She uses terms like anecdotal information. It's purely speculative. It could be hypothesized, though not specifically evaluated in this analysis. So she clearly identifies things she had nothing to do with. It does say somebody supplied information, pictures about wakeboard boats and a movie. It came from somewhere. Nobody's admitting to it, but somebody supplied that. But it says the reviewer supplied it. But essentially what you're doing is you're taking a scientific study that was done on multiple wakeboard boats in 2008, so it's current, under techniques that are designed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and you're challenging that and saying that's no good. And you're taking an arbitrary multiplier of 2.5 times and saying this boat can make a 4-foot wake. Wakeboard boats don't make 4-foot wakes. They just don't. And what I worry about, the reason I'm bringing it up, because the erosion studies pass, or hopefully you'll continue to look at it, is we may be setting up a situation here where you're going to get a kind of a class war between wakeboard boaters and those who don't boat or whatever. Now, I have both kinds of boats, and I rarely ever use my wakeboard boat for wakeboarding, you know. So, but it's just the bigger boat, and we put people on it. But it's you can't have information in a public document like that. That is just, it's just completely speculative. You're just looking at it, and you might as well use 5 times or 10 times. I mean, one wakeboard boat's called a tsunami, but I don't think it makes a tsunami-sized wave. So please review that section when you look at it again. Consider removing it. It says in there it's a sensitivity analysis, but the reality of it is you're creating wake sizes that don't matter. And I don't understand it, because in reality it kind of takes away a case for lake level having any impact, because now you're throwing these giant waves out there. Obviously the erosion isn't the lake level, it's this tsunami-sized wave that you've got coming down the lake that simply doesn't exist on the back of these boats. They don't make four-foot waves. And she clearly says that in the study. It could not be substantiated. They could find no evidence of that. So I just ask you to consider that. I don't want a class war going. It happens. It's dangerous. This is a harmonious lake, and there are places where, you know, the Willamette River 2 years ago, all summer long, there's a huge battle. It was decided that the wakeboard boats did not cause any additional erosion. But people got in and they hate each other. So let's just please be sensitive and careful. That's it. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Additional public comment?
I want to just do a little demonstration for everybody. Mitch talked about that. There is a 4 foot wave. You all know that there's just no way you see that out there. The other thing I want to talk to you all about too in that study is what is classified, and I think this was in the first part of the study, the recreational period of the lake that I think is defined, Paul, you correct me if I'm wrong, from April 15th through September 15th or September 30th.
October 15th.
Yeah, October 15th. So what I would tell you, anybody, I've been coming to the lake for 40 years. I've had property here for 18 years. And what I would tell you, the recreational period of time is about a three-month window between about mid-June and mid-September. And also what I would tell you is any one of us that come down on a weekday during that recreational period can have the lake all to ourselves. And there are very few weekends that the lake gets busy enough, even close to what compares to, you know, the activity that you'd find on a river or a major waterway like that. So we're blessed in that area. But what I would caution you about, and what I'd encourage you, Paul, to find out also, is that wave analysis. Look at the period of time, the number of boats, you know, and you guys did, and David, I got to give you credit, you pointed out one really good thing. You've also got to look at the, you know, the mix of boats, because what I can tell you is during the morning, typically we get the water ski boats, you know, sometimes in the morning, the later evening, you get the wakeboard boats. They aren't all out there at the same time. There's a lot of mix of boats. There's a lot of wakeboard boats. Probably the average speed on the lake is probably going to be in that 25 to 35 to 37 mile an hour, which, again, drops your wake height. So be really cautious of the data that you're using. And that's all I encourage you to do, and I thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks, Mark. Board comments or announcements? Just want to remind everybody that May 10th is our next meeting. So it's the second Thursday of the month instead of the first. It will be here as normal, followed by the budget committee meeting on, is it Friday or Saturday?
Friday.
On Friday.
Friday, 10 a.m.
And will that be here?
Here as well.
That'll
Thank
be
you,
here
man.
As well. So that's the only announcements that I have. Anyone else?
I'll say something, I guess.
Please do.
Just thanks, Paul, for dissecting that down so at least I could understand it. I appreciate it. And one thing I'd like to address is that there were some concerns that somehow that there was a preconceived ending to this report, that it was going to somehow things were being manipulated so we'd have an outcome that was predetermined. And frankly, as a new board member, I don't have a boat on the lake. I don't fish and don't have property. I don't even eat fish. But I do share in common with these guys the love of the lake. And certainly no one has come to me with a predetermined aspect of this report that we paid for. And just because we paid for the report doesn't mean that we have to believe every word that's in it. I certainly don't. And I've had huge concerns with the first report, not because it didn't say what I wanted it to say, but because I've looked at the report, I didn't find parts of it very well researched or believable, and I was happy that Paul took the time to flesh it out. And the fact that they didn't offer any recommendations, that's not their job. I mean, they're basically giving us information, and it's Paul's job to make the information so we can understand it, and those final recommendations are our job. That's our what we're supposed to be doing. So anyway, I hope we can go through this process good-spirited and all in care and love of the lake, which is one thing we all share.
Thanks, Kip.
Thank you, Kip.
Okay. Please make sure you thank Tetra Tech for the hard work.
Yeah, we'll do. And thank you all for bearing with the 3.5-hour meeting there to review all that.
So I'm going
to
adjourn the meeting.
Fuck out.